Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Towns and cities all over England voted to leave the EU last Thursday. The BBC's Seema Kotecha has gone back to her hometown of Basingstoke in southern England to find out why they voted to go. There is some highly offensive language in her report.
Sifting through some old school pictures with my father, Suresh.
Gosh, I was about five.
You and your brother were very young, 5 and 7 years old, and there were no ethnic minority over there in the school at that stage.
It's changed, hasn't it?
Now it has become a very cosmopolitan situation since those days.
No, we continue.
A town which was once monocultural has become multicultural over the past couple of decades. Now more than 11% of the population here is made up of other ethnic groups besides white British.
Good, well done. Let's keep going then. It's really good.
At the local Vine School, maths teacher Neil Pooney says his pupils embrace all cultures and religions.
Certainly within the classes, we have students from Poland, Romania, Nepal, Hungary, Lithuania, you name it, all over the EU and non-EU as well, and that has certainly increased over the last 10 years.
In the EU referendum, the borough of Basingstoke and Deane voted to leave. Its results were reflective of the national picture, with 52% wanting out and 48% wanting to stay in. So, was immigration a factor in how people voted here? At a local pub, a man tells me he's pleased with the outcome because of the rising numbers of foreigners in the town. It's not long before he begins uttering racial slurs towards me, including a word that Asian people find especially offensive.
I think all the immigrants, they should leave the country, you know what I mean?
So are you talking about Eastern Europeans?
Yeah, like, not saying like Pakis, I'm saying like all of them, do you know what I mean?
Did you say Pakis?
No, I don't mean sorry, love.
That's offensive.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, no, I didn't mean to come across, but it's all them, like, they're not foreigners. We all bleed the same, we've got the same heart, but it's a different colour skins, you know what I mean?
So do you not like Asians either?
No, I do like Asians. I'm not racist.
You just use the word
yeah,
Paki.
Yeah, I know I use Paki, but I've come out of more offensive. Well, you know what I mean? But I'm not like that. I'm not racist at all, any shape or way.
But it's not clear whether this type of discourse is an occurrence of the referendum debate. I'm told by the lady behind the bar, this sort of talk, the P word, is nothing new in this pub.
I'm rather shocked because that man just called me the P word.
A lot of people do use that word quite freely. You'll be surprised because, without meaning to sound rude, your skin colour's different. Naive people will look at you and think, you're not English. And that's the way people are around here.
In an old manor house on the outskirts of Basingstoke, Jeff Botel sits in a sparse room facing a field. He's a psychotherapist and voted to leave the EU. He says it angers him when people here say immigration has been the driving force of the referendum.
In fact, my view is that immigration is being used by those who are unhappy with the decision that has been made. I just have this feeling that I would like to be in a position where every so often, every few years, I can both elect and deselect the people who make the rules that govern my country.
The think tank Open Europe has said that Leave voters are a mix of liberal globalists and UKIP voters, something that seems to be mirrored in this town. With a population makeup that continues to evolve, many here tell me the new relationship with Europe is more important than ever, with a hope their needs will be put first. Richard is 22 and voted to leave the EU.
I feel personally it's better we're out because we can just sit down, get everything sorted, put ourselves first instead of someone who isn't actually caring for our interests.
Seema Kotecha reporting. Well, whether you're happy or sad about Brexit, it's clearly a momentous time in European history. Dan Damon asked Margaret McMillan, a professor of international history at the University of Oxford, how significant she rates this moment in European and world history.
I think it could be huge. I mean, historians are very reluctant to predict the future, but I do have this feeling that we may look back and say something really shifted then, and we may not look back and think that that shift led to good things. I mean, I think one of the things the campaign did was make it okay to utter sentiments like the ones we've just heard, that we don't want those people here, they take our benefits, I'm not against any of them personally. And that's now become more acceptable. And if the negotiations about leaving the EU drag on, I think we may well hear more of that.
It's kind of redolent of the 1930s. I'm not the only one to make that comparison. I noticed the Wall Street Journal today, for example, also said that there are some aspects to the populism that is current in Britain, in Europe, and in the United States that does remind people, historians perhaps, of the 1930s. Do you feel that?
It does in some ways. I mean, there are never exact parallels with the past, but I do think what I think is interesting is what's happening in Britain is not just happening in Britain, it's happening elsewhere in the US and in parts of Europe. And I think we have gone through a time of economic turmoil, partly, I think, caused by globalization, which has benefited some but done a lot of damage to others. It's helped to deindustrialize countries. It's led to a loss of jobs, a decline in wages, a decline in status. And I think also the great economic crash of 2008 is still working its way out. And I think there's a lot of anger out there. There's a lot of feeling that something in the system is broken. Some people are sitting comfortably at the top, you know, collecting huge bonuses, and the rest of us are not gaining from what's been happening, and no one seems to be worrying about the ordinary people. And that can lead, as it did in the late 20s and 30s, to a search for simple solutions and a search for people who say, look, I've got all the answers, trust me, I'll fix it. And of course, in the 1930s, that led to people moving to the political extremes, either towards the communists or towards various varieties of fascism or right-wing parties. And it's an understandable reaction. I just think it's a very dangerous one. And I think what we have to hope is that the center will hold, as it did in many countries in the 1930s. I mean, we remember the bad examples, we remember the dreadful examples, but we should remember that in France there was a Popular Front government, that in Britain the institutions held, in the United States the institutions held, in my own country, Canada, the institutions and the center held. So I'd like to be optimistic, but I think we're in for turbulent times.
Councillors in Coventry are calling for a special debate to formally condemn racist incidents seen in the city following Britain's vote to leave the European Union. The police have promised zero tolerance, and while they say there hasn't been a significant rise in the number of incidents, there have been several, including one involving BBC TV and radio presenter Tricia Dudu yesterday. Well, Trish is with me now. Hi, Trish. Now, you were racially abused in the street. I mean, tell us what happened exactly. The city centre, wasn't it?
Yes, a city centre car park. I was getting into my car and noticed there was some really nasty bar language coming out from an individual against what appeared to be a student, an Asian student. It's really derogatory, the use of the P word, and, you know, sort of shouting about, hadn't you seen the vote? I was just paralysed in fear, Nick. I mean, you know me as a hardened journalist. It takes a lot to really, sort of upset me. And then obviously, then he turned his attentions to me and started, basically, he said, you know, go home.
Nigger! Gosh, that is really strong stuff. How did you react to that?
Well, he just kept shouting, like, nigger and nigger.
Nigger!
You know, you're not supposed to be here. Oh, gosh, yeah, definitely.
Have you ever had that before?
Never. Sorry.
No.
Sorry.
I mean, I'm actually shaken as well to hear it. And you weren't planning to report it, were you? But
no,
changed your mind.
No. I literally was such in shock, and there were people walking past, but I think they just didn't know what to do. And I wasn't going to report it because I just think the police are so busy. You know, you hear that, you know, they've got so much more on their plate. And it was people on the social network that said, you must report it. And I'm so glad I did, because the police have been absolutely fantastic, Nick. And anyone who thinks the police do not take what is a hate crime seriously, they do. And it was just, I've lived in this country, I'm proud.
I was going to say you couldn't be more British, could you?
Yeah, and I don't think Coventry is a racist city at all. I just think this one individual just seemed so full of hate, Nick. He was incessant with rage, both at the student and at me.
It's really shaking you up.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Telling us to go home, and I don't like using the N-word, and I haven't heard it directly to me, but it was shocking.
Trish, thanks for coming to speak to us anyway.
The story that really hits home for us. Our co-workers were assaulted while covering the breaking news yesterday.
Yeah, reporter Emmy Victor and photojournalist Zachary Hayes were across the street from the scene of that officer-involved shooting yesterday morning in Boone when a woman approached them and started yelling racial slurs, using profanity, and placing her hands on Emmy Victor. Here's a video of that encounter.
Now get the f*** out of here, you stupid f***ing
nigga!
Don't you ever tell me. I f***ing told you who was dead. So don't stand there and tell me you don't know. Get the out of here. One, you're gonna start going down. So what do you want to do? We keep going? Get the out of here.
Ridiculous. You're gonna have to go.
No, you're gonna.
We're calling the police.
We're calling the cops on you.
You shoot me too. Come on, right here. Come, come, shoot me. Come on. Let's go.
Stressful situation there. Victor and Hayes were not physically injured in the attack, but they obviously were shaken up. Police later identified that woman as the mother of the man who was shot and killed. KCCI General Manager Brian Sather released this statement. He wrote, "The safety of our crews is critically important as they cover stories affecting our communities. Emmy and Zach demonstrated the utmost professionalism in the face of a very difficult, emotionally charged situation."
That they did. Mm-hmm. They handled that very well.
I went to jail for income tax evasion, right? You know, I didn't know a motherfucking thing about no taxes. I told the judge, said, "Your Honor, I forgot." You know, he said, "You remember next year, nigga." Start writing on your ass. They give niggas time like it's lunch down there. You go down there looking for justice, that's what you find, just us. Day one, nigga, 40 years, man. I saw the judge at 40 years straight up.
40 years, boom. That's right, fella, 40 years. You want some more time, buddy?
The judge, who gave a white student athlete just 6 months in county jail for the sexual assault of an unconscious woman, is being accused of racial bias. The judge is Aaron Persky, and the case was that of star student athlete Brock Turner and his sexual assault of an unconscious woman. In a similar case, Judge Persky gave a Latino man accused and convicted of sexual assault 3 years in state prison. Raul Ramirez is an immigrant from El Salvador who pled guilty to sexually assaulting his roommate. The similarity between the two cases and the disparity in the sentencing provoked headlines around race and sentencing and a campaign to recall Persky. In the Stanford rape case, the sexual assault was interrupted by two cyclists. The case drew national headlines at the time and again when the victim's powerful letter to her rapist was read in court after the judge's sentence was delivered. So Turner was convicted of 3 felony counts of sexual assault. It turns out, though, Judge Aaron Persky was also a former Stanford athlete. Turner was a star swimmer. And during his sentence delivery, Persky spoke specifically of the impact of the trial and conviction on not the victim, but Turner. The cyclist's witness testimony also offered a rare reality in sexual assault cases, independent third-party corroboration. So, elite white star athlete gets 6 months in county jail for 3 felony counts of sexual assault. Latino man pleads guilty to sexual assault and gets 3 years in state prison. So is this about the individual treatment of defendants by judges? Or is this about dealing with the cancer of rape, a racist criminal justice system, a toxic masculinity in the ways gender and race play out for individuals within this institutional space? Let's talk race, sentencing, and rape in the criminal justice system. Sophia Quintero. Let me start with you.
It boggles my mind that some public defenders would feel that it's better to keep Persky on the bench, that that's in their interest, and using the argument that not giving judges discretion would lead to mass incarceration. Like, bro, we already have mass incarceration. And Brock Turner didn't have a public defender, so using his case as some kind of litmus test doesn't make sense to me. There's already a one-size-fits-all sentencing scheme for defendants based on race and class. How many studies do we need to have as evidence that black and brown defendants get harsher sentences for the same crime as white defendants across offenses? So I don't get this argument at all. It flies in the face of what has been established, the racial and class bias in sentencing. And when it comes to the Brock Turner case, this isn't only about the privilege of the defendant. It's also about the willingness to sympathize with the survivor, because this case got consistent media coverage. You had many highly visible white feminists making strident public statements about this case. And then compare that to where you have a police officer, Daniel Hallsclaw, assaulting 13-plus women of color, and it managed to stay, and this trial managed to stay well under the radar. And then you have the survivor in the Turner case making a very compelling and courageous statement, but I really do believe that even if she had not said anything, that there still would have been sympathy. It brings me back. I think about this case, and I think about the Central Park Five case, where for years we didn't know who the victim was. For years, but we knew she was white and that she worked in finance, and that was all we needed to know. And I just want to say that all survivors of sexual assault deserve justice, but there are certain survivors who are not going to see it because of their class, because of their race, because of their you know, national origin and status, and because of their gender identity. It's all interconnected.
Closing thought to you, Usher Bandele.
For anybody who is going to be listening to this with us, I'm sorry for the trigger, because the number of women who called me of many races who were triggered by what this judge did, just as it happened after the Daniel Hallsclaw case, you know, it's just a horrible thing to hear and to talk about, and I don't want to pretend that it's not triggering. But to Sophia's point, too, about, you know, these public defenders, I remember having a frightening conversation with a colleague of mine who served as a public defender and told me in no uncertain terms that that people would come in, right, and if they were black, they would negotiate some kind of deal that involved some sort of, you know, the least amount of jail time they could get the person, usually for some very minor offense, something probably involving some low-level possession of drugs. And when a white kid would come in for the very same crime, the public defenders would double down and say, he won't be able to survive jail. And so, you know, in many places that I've traveled to, whether it's not just in New York, but throughout the South, public defenders are all too often seen as very part and parcel of those who are driving mass incarceration, because they are not fighting. This, I'm not saying that this is true, and I have loved many a public defender in my life, but I think that we have to look at the role that, that public defenders do play in negotiating some of these deals and who they fight for and who they don't. As Sophia was saying, just even about how, you know, the women that we stand up for and the women we didn't stand up for, even in the Hallsclaw case, we only, you know, decide that we're going to, you know, that gets some attention because the woman, the black woman who was assaulted by him, said, you know, not me, I'm a good Christian, you know, grandmother and woman, and not that she should be assaulted, but all the other women who were drug using, who were sex workers, who were all those, they didn't matter. Their voices would never have been heard. And so, you know, there's a lot to unpack when it comes to this, and a lot we have to look at within our own, even allyship, as you referred to earlier, Esther, about how are we really showing up as allies? Are we fully being allies? And are we really living out the idea that every life has value?
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
After VidCon, a popular YouTuber by the name of Callum McSwiggin alleged that he was in West Hollywood, California, and was attacked by anti-gay individuals. Well, later on, it was discovered that he probably made the whole thing up. So let me give you the details on this.
Well, let me give you a little bit of context on this, because this is a story we considered covering yesterday when it came out that he was, at the time, it seemed like he was attacked. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us in the production meeting were like, this story's got red flags on it.
Yeah, we just kind of had a gut feeling that it was fake.
Our Ben Mankiewicz red flag came out, because Ben is famous for, there's something wrong with this story. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, so wait, let me get this right. You're in Anaheim, you're a relatively famous YouTuber, and someone separated you from the crowd, and they were already tracking you. It's not like it's inconceivable, and then you didn't. And then we found out later that he didn't have any marks on him when he was arrested. Mm-hmm. Like, no, we're not doing this story. There's a huge problem with this story.
Yes.
And it turns out that that was the case.
So let me give you some more details on who he is and how he lied. So he's a moderately famous 26-year-old YouTuber who makes videos with titles like Straight Guys, See My Nudes, Gay Guys, Embarrassing Sex Secrets, and Gay Love Story, My Hot Australian Boyfriend. Kind of want to check that video out.
Yeah, he plays his heart on that.
He's having fun.
I got no problems with his channel, and it's not like gay hate crimes can't happen. We report on them all the time. We had a giant one just happen in Orlando, and we're furious about it, but it doesn't help to make stuff up. That really is counterproductive.
Right. So he originally posted something on social media showing him injured, right? And so here's the picture that he posted. And in the caption, he talks about how he was targeted for being gay and he was beaten up. He says, last night was the worst night of my life, and I'm really struggling to find the words to talk about it. After one of the most wonderful weekends at VidCon, we went out to a gay club to celebrate, and towards the end of the evening, I was separated from my friends and beaten up by three guys. The authorities should have been there to help and protect me, but instead they treated me like a second-class citizen. With three broken teeth and six stitches in my forehead, I've never felt so terrified to be a gay man in the public eye. Well, cops responded to that and said, no, that's not what happened. Let me give you their details. Officers were unable to substantiate the assault. The YouTuber had no visible injuries and was arrested when officers went to the scene after deputies observed him vandalizing a car. The 26-year-old was booked and photographed, photo above, we'll show you in just a second, and placed in a cell by himself at the West Hollywood station. It was there that station personnel say that he was then observed injuring himself with a handle and receiver to a payphone inside the cell. So his booking photo looked like this.
Now, where did all those stitches in his head go?
Come on.
Don't do that.
Before you post this nonsense online, I don't know what his incentives were for doing that. Just think about the paper trail that you've just left behind.
It's so obvious to figure out. So, look, if you think it was weird for me to, wonder why it couldn't happen, it could happen. It happens all the time all across America. It's just there was so much talk at VidCon, because we were there, about security. And some of the more famous YouTubers had bodyguards with them because of what happened to Christina Grimmie, and that's very understandable. So there's just a lot of attention being paid to people with security issues. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of people there looking for attention. So now you've got attacks against gays in the news, you've got attacks against YouTubers in the news, and the people with bodyguards are getting an enormous amount of attention. Here is an up-and-coming YouTuber all of a sudden saying, look at me, I'm gay and I got attacked. And I thought, well, that is an interesting coincidence, but it could certainly happen.
Yeah.
Then you find out the stitches on his head aren't there in his mugshot. Then apparently they've got video of him smashing himself with a payphone. That doesn't look good. And remember, every time you cry wolf, it hurts the cause of all gay Americans when they deal with real violence and people go, oh yeah, remember that time that guy made it up? Ah, it's all BS.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of the story that Rolling Stone did of Jackie, who alleged that she had been raped on campus, right? And then it turns out that a lot of her claims were false, and Rolling Stone had to retract that article. It did a huge disservice to the women who are sexually assaulted or raped on campuses, because it immediately makes people doubt them. And so you don't want to hurt the cause like that. I mean, it does so much more harm than good. And again, I don't know why he did this or what his incentives were, but it was a really bad idea, to say the least.
Say you got three broken teeth and six stitches in your head. If you don't actually have those stitches or broken teeth, You think nobody's going to realize that? That is really ridiculous. So it's a very unfortunate story. But look, as much sympathies as we clearly have on this show for victims of hate crimes and victims of sexual assault in other cases, that same sympathy is what leads us to call out BS mm-hmm. when people are just clamoring for attention and trying to do this instead. It's the terrible way to go. And by the way, let me just add one more thing for Callum. Look, if, as everyone or a lot of people suspect, this isn't true, you can go down one of two directions. Keep on saying it. And by the way, you'll keep a lot of your hardcore fans. They'll believe you and they'll think the world's against you. They'll hate us. They'll hate anyone who reports the opposite, even if there's videotape. Mm-hmm. They won't believe it. Because once you got some fans, they'll be with you. I mean, I just debated a conservative. She said the most preposterous things. And some of his fans were like, yeah, like you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but don't think you won on that. The much better way to go is, my God, I'm so, so sorry. Like, I realize why this is such a terrible thing. And I don't know if you can forgive me, but I'm asking for that forgiveness. If you ask me, that's the much better way to go, if indeed it was faked, which you saw the pictures.
I've been struggling for so very long. Been sprayed by holes, been bit by bugs, thrown in a paddle wagon and tied like horns. I'm at the end of my ribs. It seems I can't win. So crack a Jesus, where the hell you been?
Learning more tonight about two white men charged with a hate crime after yelling racial slurs and throwing eggs at a black woman waiting for a bus on South Grand Friday night.
And perhaps the most surprising thing about the suspects is where they both worked. Fox News' Paul Shankman is live in South St. Louis now, where these crimes took place. Paul?
Yeah, Mandy, it happened to an African-American woman waiting for a bus here Friday night on South Grand near Chippewa. Someone drove by, threw an egg at her, and yelled a three-word sentence, quote, black,
nigger,
N-word, B-word. But a witness believed to be a Metro driver says he thinks that there may be more than one victim.
I just think everybody need to grow up, man. Who throws eggs on Grand?
Well, these guys, according to court documents, and they are grown up, both 30 years old. On the left is David Reagan. On the right, Jesse Reed. Both are from Jefferson County, and both work at the same place, a Baldwin-based prison outreach ministry called Mission Gate.
We were in utter shock. We were just, you know, very discouraged, very sad, and very shocked. And my husband said right away, they have to go.
But before Trish Mathis could fire them, she says both men called her to resign.
Jesse said that he was very, very sorry that, you know, very tearful. He did say that David had done it, yes. I was in shock. I asked him, did you do that? And he said that he did not, but he was driving the car.
And it wasn't just any car. According to Mathis and confirmed by law enforcement sources, the men were riding in a church van from New Hope Fellowship in High Ridge, where Mathis says Jesse Reed occasionally preached. The pastor is not commenting except to say that Reed was not a member of the church staff.
I think this is appalling.
Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce says a witness indicated there were more victims, and she hopes they will come forward.
This is a deeply disturbing act. I can't imagine what people are thinking who come up and commit that kind of a crime.
Well, the head of the prison ministry finds this inconceivable, particularly because the job that these two guys were doing for the ministry was to help people coming out of prison find their way in life, and many of them are African American. They are charged with one count each of assault motivated by discrimination. That's a felony. It's a hate crime, punishable by 4 years in prison at the maximum. Both men are out tonight on bond. Live in South St. Louis, Paul Shankman, Fox 2 News.
The first thing we're going to do to, I think, stop racism is stop focusing on racism.
Stop focusing on racism.
We want to turn our attention to a story in Freetown. A racist Facebook post about a house party is sparking outrage, and now a firefighter is off the job. Seven's Nicole Oliverio live with us this morning to explain what this firefighter is accused of writing, Nicole, that has him in so much trouble.
Chris, not only does it have him in trouble, he lost his job because of it. We just spoke with the fire chief. He says that this firefighter has since apologized, but it violated the department's Facebook policy. He's accused of making racist comments. Now, these comments were in relation to a party that happened in Assonet last month. There were about 1,000 people at this party. Apparently, neighbors were calling, saying that it was getting out of hand, that it was too loud, and it actually took the police department about 3 hours to break up this party. So this firefighter apparently on his own personal Facebook page wrote, quote, I can see the next fire call will be this house on fire, and I'll make sure I can't find the hydrant. Just make sure no water, so no more house parties with black Boston people. Now, the owners of the home and the people who threw the party were, in fact, black. Again, the fire chief saying that this on-call paid volunteer firefighter who had been with the department for 5 years has since been fired. They also say they have a policy in place regarding social media posts. They say they'll be reviewing it and going over with all firefighters again.
First, I asked him if he actually did it. You know, I asked him, did you actually make these posts? He said, yes. And, you know, I said, oh, you realize what's happening now. And he said, yeah. He said, I screwed up. He says, I'm sorry. He says, he apologized to me. He apologized to his fellow firefighters. And he basically apologized to the entire town that he's sorry that he did it.
Now, the chief says he hasn't heard from anybody who owned that home who threw the party complaining about the post. That's the latest live in Freetown. Nicole Oliverio, 7 News, Today in New England.
Marijuana is legal in Colorado as long as you're 21 years old or older. It is still illegal for kids to possess, and so juveniles are coming to dominate the marijuana arrests in Colorado. But another trend has also developed. As Colorado Public Radio's Ben Marcus reports, arrest rates have risen dramatically for young blacks and Latinos.
Courtroom 4F in Denver is where most young offenders must explain themselves to a judge. In the hallway, Ricky Montoya didn't look fazed by the judge's order that he pay a $1,000 fine for his third marijuana possession offense. Nor was he shocked to learn that police are increasingly citing and arresting Latinos like him.
Well, yeah, they probably look at us more different. Like, they probably think... I don't think they think that white people would smoke as much as we do.
In fact, a Colorado Health Department survey found that there wasn't a huge racial difference in who smokes pot, yet the arrest rate for white kids is falling, while the black and Latino arrest rate is rising. And that was evident at the courthouse, where about a dozen cases were heard before noon, and only one involved a white kid.
And that needs to stop.
Brian Vicente led the marijuana legalization movement in Colorado.
You know, that is, I think, a large part of the reason Colorado voters passed legalization is they're tired of the sort of racist legacy of the drug.
drug war.
Vicente says it's shameful that local police have shifted their attention to minority kids. But outside Denver Police Headquarters, spokesman Sonny Jackson rejects the idea that they're targeting black and Latino kids for pot offenses.
Most of these cases are complaint-driven. We get a complaint from someone, we're not sure where it's going to take us, but we have to act on it. And we're not sure if I get a call to a residence or to a location, who I'm going to encounter as I get there.
Jackson points out that pot arrests for adults of all racial groups have been cut in half since legalization, and he emphasizes that marijuana is a low priority for the department. Keith Humphreys, who studies drug policy at Stanford, says in general, police departments don't explicitly target racial groups. But the fact is, pot is illegal for kids, so police have to do something when they encounter it.
And police do patrol more in neighborhoods of color. They also get more calls to respond in neighborhoods of color.
And Humphreys theorizes that the marijuana businesses themselves may be playing a role in who gets arrested.
The emerging legal marijuana industry is overwhelmingly white-owned and white-dominated and provides good access to white customers. So one possibility is that that leaves the illegal market disproportionately composed of people of color, both the buyers and the sellers.
That's an issue that touches Wanda James, who owns the Simply Pure dispensary in a gentrified neighborhood in Denver. As a black woman, she is an anomaly in the industry. And news that minorities are being arrested at higher rates for marijuana offenses makes her angry.
Because I sit here every day in my dispensary, and you can hear my receptionist speaking now. We're busy. You hear those little bells going off? People are walking in here right now. It's Friday. We are selling a ton of cannabis today.
And most of her customers are white. But she makes sure to point out that this is not just a Colorado or Denver problem.
There is not a major city. There is not a major city, small town, rural county, city county, outskirts, beach community that does not have this exact same problem where they're arresting and targeting people of color.
So despite the benefits of legalization, whether it's safe access to pot or increased tax revenue, it hasn't solved the intractable issue of race in America's war on drugs. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
In a year, Black Lives Matter protesters have been calling for change within the justice system. And now, it finally looks like it's going to actually happen. The Justice Department announced earlier this week that 33,000 federal agents and prosecutors must undergo training to stop their bias from influencing law enforcement decisions. The department has come under fire for telling local police officers to create policies against bias while not having a plan of their own. In a memo to Justice Department employees, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates says the program is supposed to identify implicit biases. She defines those as subtle, unconscious stereotypes nearly everyone makes about certain groups of people. Another portion of the memo says, quote, but implicit bias also presents unique challenges to effective law enforcement because it can alter where investigators and prosecutors look for evidence and how they analyze it without their awareness or ability to compensate. The Justice Department will use a guide created by the former director of the Police Executive Research Forum. The organization is a nonprofit that provides expertise on policing issues. Joining me now is Nicole Austin Hillary. She's the director and counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law. And on the phone from New York City is Kristen Clark. She is the president and CEO of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. And also in the studio today is panel Dr. Greg Carr, the Department Chair of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. Carmen Berkeley is the Civil, Human, and Women's Rights Director for AFL-CIO. And Ralph Chittums is the Senior Vice Chairman for the D.C. Republican Party. Considering all of the major cases, such as Michael Brown and Tamir Rice, which resulted in no charges being filed, as we all know, is this training too little, too late? I want to turn first to Nicole. What do you think?
I don't think it is
ever too late to have training that is going to ensure that agents and lawyers who are working in the Department of Justice are more sensitive to and more aware of racial bias. We know the Harvard Law School has been working on the implicit assessment test for quite some time. Corporations have been using it. Employment discrimination lawyers have been using it. So we know that it makes a difference. I'm just very glad that the Department of Justice finally sees that it is now time for them to start using this same kind of research and information to ensure that their officers and lawyers are better trained to be more sensitive to the issues of people from varying communities.
And Kristen, if I could turn to you, are you there?
I am.
Hi, I want to turn to you. I know that you are quite an authority on civil rights work, and I want to ask your opinion. Do you think that a system like this, where you have implicit biases, is this the same thing as racial profile training? What's the distinction here?
That we distinguish implicit bias from outright racial animus. Implicit bias, again, refers to this unconscious bias, meaning that there are groups that draw stereotypes about racial groups, groups that draw stereotypes about African Americans. But that is to be kept distinct from outright racial animus that some police officers harbor towards racial groups. I think that what the justice has done here is a very important first step in helping to raise the standards of policing, raise the standards that are used by federal law enforcement agencies across our country. And they're helping to set a new benchmark for the vast numbers of police departments and sheriff's offices around the country. I mean, hopefully they will to follow the Justice Department's lead and institute implicit bias training for their officers. But we still got to work to purge the bad apples. We know that there are some cops like Daniel Pantaleo in New York City involved in the death of Eric Garner, Darren Wilson involved in the death of Michael Brown, Michael Slager involved in the death of Walter Scott. There are bad apples out there who are driven by racial animus. And I think that that is a separate problem that demands stronger medicine, that demands that the Justice Department bring suit and work to bring charges against officers who violate the civil rights of victims.
Dr. Carr, I want to ask you, when you hear statements like what Kristen Clark is saying and what Nicole is talking about, do you find it odd that the Justice Department is just now instituting a policy that they had forced other local entities to do? Are they playing catch up, or are they really being leaders here?
No, I mean, I don't think it's odd. I mean, you know, I think the ultimate solution, if there's going to be a solution in an experiment like we have here in the United States in plurality, is to hire more non-white folks and to have a mix of law enforcement officials that look like the country. I don't know that you can address implicit bias. I mean, you look at the work of Jennifer Eberhardt, and I appreciate what you said, because that really reminds me of the fact that, you know, implicit bias training can only go so far. If you had a police force and law enforcement that looked like the rest of the country, I think that would probably go a lot farther than
Well, that's true if you didn't always have the color blue trumping other things. I mean, do have, you know, black officers and Latino officers who are also involved in that sort of bias and that sort of prejudice. Carmen, what are your thoughts in terms of the training that's being initiated? Is this a good thing? And is Dr. Carr right? Do we just have to have people mirror the communities to solve the issue?
Well, actually, you know, in the labor movement, we're having an implicit training, an implicit bias training on Friday, and we've actually been doing these trainings over the past year with different unions. Obviously, many law enforcement corrections officers are represented by unions, and so for us, it's a great first step because it allows for people to enter into the conversation, not necessarily around race or gender or even sexual identity, but around the biases that we all have. And even though for us as black people, we want to be able to talk about the explicit bias, the racism, the not liking someone and shooting them, but if that's what brings people to the table, then great. I think for us in the labor movement, we also have goals that go along with it. And so as long as the Justice Department is also saying, we will train you, and then what is our goal to get to a place where people are not being shot on the street, that's the best way to implement implicit bias training.
Nicole, I want you to have the last word on this issue. Speaking of unions, do you think that officers are going to be, and prosecutors are going to be receptive to sort of training, or do they think they have a different role?
You know, I think they will be receptive. I will tell you, several years ago, the Brennan Center did a report on racial disparities in federal prosecutions, where we brought together groups of former federal prosecutors to talk about how race impacted their work. And I will tell you that many of them talked even then about the fact that this kind of training would be very helpful. Now, certainly within any industry, there will be people who are reticent. We know this. But the fact that the department is saying, look, regardless of whether you're reticent or not, everyone has to take this, I think it's going to bring everyone to a point where they will learn some things about themselves. I like the point that you made about the fact that there is the color blue. That's why this is so important. We all have biases, as you've mentioned. I remember the first time I took this test, I was quite, I won't share what my outcome was, but I will say that I was quite surprised at what it showed. So I think that even with the reticence, even with some of the people within DOJ who may feel that they don't need this, I think at the end of the day, they're all going to find that they will benefit from this and the department will be better served as a result.
Say, brother, can I get some of that water, man? Just a little bit, you know, maybe like a drop or two. You got all the water in the world, brother. Just let me get a little bit, please. That's all I can get. I mean, I see you over there shining with all that water, man. I just need a little bit. I mean, it's hard out here.
We have an update on the Flint water crisis. Federal agencies involved in the investigation say that filtered water in that city is now safe to drink. The Environmental Protection Agency, in conjunction with the Centers for Disease Control, along with local and state agencies, released a statement saying, in part, the use of NSF-verified filters makes water safe from lead for all populations. Pregnant and nursing women and children no longer need to drink bottled water to avoid lead exposure as long as they drink water that has passed through a filter rated to remove lead from drinking water. However, Flint Mayor Karen Weaver says that some homes have faucets where filters do not fit. Thus, bottled water is still needed in some homes. So what's going on? I'm going to talk about this with my panel. Still on the panel is Will Jawando, former Obama White House official, Lauren Victoria Burke, managing editor of Politico 365, and Gianna Caldwell, Republican strategist of Caldwell Strategic Consulting. So what's going on in Flint, you guys? Are we past the storm, or are they still facing some challenges that still have to be overcome?
The storm is still here. Anytime, I mean, really, they say, I'm not sure if you guys are aware, but bottled water in Flint was going for about $10 for one bottle of water.
Oh my God.
People are suffering here. This is like a very poor town, and the fact that they're saying, oh, you know, we're good to go, we got these filters, I don't think it's sufficient. I think that they really need to do something to reimburse these folks who have spent countless dollars, these folks that have been harmed by this poisonous water. Yep. They need to make sure that there's some way where these people are being compensated, because there was obviously negligence by the state and local officials, including the federal government,
absolutely,
for that matter.
Every level of government.
Yeah. I mean, look, couple things happening here. One, you know, my church, we just did another drive and went down to Flint, so there's still people struggling. They still need water. They're understandably scared to drink out of their faucets and out of their homes because of they've been lied to before.
Right.
The governor still needs to resign.
Yeah.
I mean, this is if anyone else would have done this in any other state, I mean, they would have had his head on a platter. And it was a failure of government at all levels. I will say the EPA has come in and really stepped up from all reports I've heard to really try to reassure people. They're going to do a lot of sessions with people to show how the water's, you know, I think we might need to get President Obama out drinking another cup, mm-hmm, you know, because it you know, that scare, that fear is real. When you're seeing, you know, yellow purple water, but
yeah. But
I think you know, we have to hold people accountable, and that starts at the top, I think, with the governor.
But what's going on in Congress? I mean, Lauren, still we have a Congress that is supposed to be doing something about this, and it's been blocked time after time. What's happening?
Yeah, well, it was blocked. The money was blocked to help Flint by Senator Mike Lee, who I walked up to in the hallway and asked about this, and he don't want to talk about it because he doesn't do hallway interviews. So Congress, as usual,
doesn't do his job either, apparently.
Yeah. Well, I think he views his job as, you know, cutting anything that would be any sort of budget allocation, even if it's for American citizens. But, I mean, I think the primary problem with this is that it was never really raised to the level of importance and national attention that it should have in the first place. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think that the president should have used his bully pulpit a lot earlier to do that, because this is a group of Americans in an American city having a problem that they shouldn't be having with a basic need, which, of course, is water. There's all this sort of shrugging of the shoulders on the federal level about, well, this is a local crisis, so we shouldn't say anything about it, which I think is completely wrong. Yeah. We allocate money all the time for other countries, for things
Absolutely.
That are going on in other countries. And when it comes to Americans here, and this is why I think Donald Trump's message has some currency. Mm-hmm. You know, if you start hammering home a message of taking care of Americans first right. and focus on America, you're going to get a lot of attention, because we've just had about 8 years of, you know, every other person someplace else being a priority yeah. except the people here. So I think the White House made a mistake
agreed.
By not making it a priority.
Agreed. But it's hard for him to make that argument when his own party is holding up funding to address the issue.
What do you mean? Hard for Trump? I don't think it was hard for the president. You know, Trump is a political candidate. I'm not expecting a hell of a lot out of him. I'm expecting something out of the president. Right.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, and if we really want to look at it, he has used executive order after executive order to reallocate funds for everything, right? The Syrian refugees, he's allocated funding for those folks that are coming here for job training programs and all these other things. Wouldn't that money be better spent on the south and west sides of Chicago? Yes. Wouldn't that money be better spent in Flint, Michigan? Yes. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it? Okay.
Gotta wrap up.
Okay.
Gotta wrap up. This is just another example, I would argue, of environmental racism, and it's one but one. But that's one of the reasons why some are blaming also for the disproportionate impact of high lead levels in tap water in predominantly black communities all over the country, not just Flint. According to the Black Family Summit, which is made up of civic, political, and health organizations, that group was here in Washington, D.C. last week to host a town hall to discuss problems that may arise from water contamination if action is not taken immediately.
In our community, some people call this an emergency, others call it a crisis, some call it a disaster, and others will mark it and say, put the yellow tape around it because it's a crime scene. Depends on how you frame it, how you categorize it, what resources you get. Because it's not a disaster, there are some federal resources that we're not eligible for. But we are in this for the long haul. I can't share with you everything everybody feels, but I share with you a perspective of our community. This disaster crisis was framed as a poor, black, underserved, underprivileged African-American issue. When in fact, every member of our community, no matter what the socioeconomic status is, no matter what the racial ethnic perspective is, we were all affected.
Joining me right now, Dr. Mawata Kevin Washington, president of the Association of Black Psychologists, who was a panelist at that particular event. Docs, so when we talk about this, the idea of environmental racism, one, that hasn't often been used in describing Flint. But we also are seeing this all around the country. We're seeing this on playgrounds. We're seeing this where lead levels are appearing in schools. It's all over the place. And a lot of these states don't have required testing to check these lead levels. And that's having an impact on our children.
Right. So all over the country, this is happening, of course, in your home area in around Houston. There was an area that had a playground that had a lot of lead and other chemicals in it. We must be clear that it's not just simply the lead that was in the pipes that's the problem in this space, but also the idea of the toxic water that actually exacerbated the lead inside the paint. So it's two issues. I mean, inside of the pipes. It's two issues. One is, of course, the lead, but also the arsenic and other chemicals that are inside of the water. And that begins to be that's the idea of environmental racism. Also, you know about the zone between Beaumont, Texas and Louisiana called the Cancer Alley, with the environmental racism dynamics there. Also in Brownsville, Texas. So this is a continuing process. And so this town hall meeting was about looking at the dynamics of benign neglect on a community and imposing one's will to determine how they should retrieve the most vital element that humans need, which which is water, right? So,
And I think what people also, and we're seeing this with Flint, the fact that they're going to have to study these children, monitor them for the next 20 plus years, and even not only the kids who are alive today, but any child that is born, we've even seen some mothers lose their children
yes.
as a result of this contamination.
Yes, because, and so that was one of the discussions yesterday about what should happen, what should take place, and so testing for perpetuity, right, for their entire lives should be done. Not only does lead cause problems with cognitive development, but which then means then that if a child is not able to think in a certain way, then they cannot learn in school, which means that their pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness has been thwarted. Therefore, the inalienable right of being a citizen has also been denied. So it is genocidal act on multiple levels.
What's next in terms of what are you calling on the folks watching, listening to do on this very issue?
So the next is that how do we begin to talk about enacting an office of environmental justice in every state, right? That was part of our conversation. How do you engage in the process of making sure that there is justice granted to every individual that receives basic resources in life? How do you justify taking a water supply from one area, Detroit, and then averting it to another area and divert, and then you charge people twice, you know, more than any other water supply in the entire
right.
country? All right, and so we talk about the issue of how do societies or communities have resources that are affordable, but also that they are safe.
All right, well, Dr. Washington, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll keep raising the banner on this issue.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Forget this chain, because this ain't me. Though I'm eternally grateful to Jay-Z. We're so elated, we celebrated like Obama waited until his last day in office to tell the nation brothers is getting their reparations. Hey, a man can dream, can he? No disrespect in terms of change, I haven't seen any. Maybe he had good intentions, but was stifled by the system and was sad to learn he actually couldn't bring any. That's what I get for thinking this world is fair. They let a brother steer the ship and never told him that the ship was sinking.
We are finishing a unique examination of President Obama's years in office, and we have a preview this morning.
An NPR News team has traveled a good part of the country. This was the assignment. Ask voters how their lives have changed these past 8 years. Their answers became part of an NPR radio documentary. It will be heard on many NPR stations in the coming weeks.
People we met from Denver to Philadelphia include Kwame Rose. He's an African-American activist in Baltimore. He was upset when President Obama criticized looting during protests last year.
What did he say that bothered you?
He called us thugs and criminals. And you don't know the story behind each one of those individuals. I was one of the people he called a thug and a criminal because I was out there.
I think the phrasing was, most people are protesting peacefully,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a small number of thugs and criminals who are destroying things.
Yeah, but even the notion to differentiate peaceful. When I was there, firsthand experiences watching people run in the stores, I didn't interpret it as violence. I interpreted it as a survival skill, a survival tactic.
So did you find the president to be supportive?
No, I don't think the president has done enough for black people.
Rose is one of many people with many points of view we hear in the documentary. We passed on his remark to President Obama during an interview this week at the White House. And the president replied, he's been working for criminal justice reform.
What I would also say, though, is that if somebody is looting, they're looting. And the notion that they're making a political statement is not always the case, because these are businesses oftentimes owned by African Americans. You have situations in which suddenly friends of mine in Baltimore, their mothers who are elderly, have to now travel across town to get their medicines because the local drugstore got torn up. And making excuses for them, I think, is a mistake. There are ways of bringing about social change that are powerful and that have the ability to pull the country together and maintain the moral high ground. And there are approaches where I may understand the frustrations, but they're counterproductive. And tearing up your own neighborhood and stealing is counterproductive.
If I were to summarize what else this young man said, I might say that he feels that he is trying to overturn what he sees as a racist or corrupt system and that you've become part of it.
Yeah. Look, Steve, I think that you can always find folks who are going to feel as if change hasn't happened fast enough. That's the nature of these issues. And by virtue of being president of the United States, if there's a problem out there, I'm the ultimate public official that people know. And if it hasn't gotten fixed in a couple of weeks, then people are going to say, why didn't you fix it? I think people would be pretty hard-pressed to not see the efforts that we put in around criminal justice reform, where we're supporting it fully.
As part of this project, we also had a look at your 2008 campaign speech in Philadelphia about race, in which you talked in one passage about anger in the black community, which you said is sometimes counterproductive, but it's real, mm-hmm. and there are reasons for it. Mm-hmm. There's another passage which I hadn't even noticed before, in which you say there is a similar anger among some in the white community who don't feel particularly privileged by their race and do feel frustrated that they're losing jobs, losing right. pensions, feel like they're losing ground.
Right.
Looking back, were you describing there the same force that is driving much of our election discussion here in 2016?
Well, not only the election discussion driving 2016, this has been an ongoing theme in American history. You can go back and during Jim Crow and segregation, and you've got black sharecroppers who have nothing, and alongside them, poor white farmers who don't have that much more except for the fact that they're white. And the degree to which a lot of politics in the South were specifically designed to make sure that that sharecropper and that white farmer didn't get together to question how the economy was structured and how they both could benefit. I mean, that's one of the oldest stories in American politics. So it's not surprising that what I said in 2008 still holds true today. It was true for a long time. The nature of racial bias in this country is unique. And the challenges that African Americans have faced are incomparable. Native Americans in this country, were burdened by extraordinary bias and cruelty, and as well. And it's probably not useful to sort of catalog every possible group's grievances. What is true, though, is that as I travel around the country, what a black working class person has in common with a white working class person is significant. And what prevents them from voting along the same lines or working together on the same projects have to do with the whole range of cultural and identity issues, which they obviously feel are important and valid. But what I've tried to do throughout my presidency is try to get people to recognize themselves and each other.
As part of our conversation with President Obama at the White House this week, we put questions to the president as part of a documentary project, 1 hour with voters and another hour with the president. Many NPR stations will broadcast those hours in days to come.
Damn you, Obama.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast. Hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 2nd, 2016. So I have been told. Always good to hear from our president. Compensatory call-in. Feel free to dial in if you have observations, questions, thoughts, suggestions, things you'd like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3600. 540. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. A couple quick things we'll get in before we get started. Number one, we should be here tomorrow. I'm still waiting on the confirmation from our guest, Steve Jimenez, discussing the Book of Matt, which I've been talking about for a minute or so, about the killing 1998 of Matthew Shepard. This is a white teen out in Wyoming. They said he was gay. He was killed. It was a hate crime where they just hated him and killed him because he was gay. And basically the theory of the book is that we have been a lot of constructive information about this case has been deliberately withheld, and that there were a lot of drug activities involved. Everybody, the individuals, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henson, the individuals, white individuals who were convicted of this crime, that they were involved in a lot of drug activity, that Matthew Shepard was involved in a lot of drug activity, and that a lot of that was kept out of the news. In fact, you had the main prosecutor in the case, as well as many of the law enforcement officers who were involved with the case, where they thought that this case had nothing to do with homophobia or them killing him or wanting to harm him because he was gay, but just this being about individuals who were involved with drugs, and this being some sort of either robbing a drug dealer or a drug transaction gone bad or someone who was a drug addict and in need of a fix, and they just had to rob somebody, and they went to rob someone who they knew typically had access to drugs and or cash or whatever the case may be. But he should be with us tomorrow. I'm hoping he will confirm so we can get ready to rock and roll tomorrow evening, normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Might be interesting summer reading. I know some of our listeners have been reading this book and kind of paying attention to some of the different things that pop up, even related, in my opinion, very much to the Orlando shooting that happened a couple weeks ago at the Pulse Club. They're saying is a gay incident, another incident of homophobia in this area of the world. Quick things I'll get before I nab some of the folks who dialed in who might have commentary. First and foremost, I think one of our callers last week had asked about the Brexit situation and if that was going to have a specific impact on black people in this part of the world. And at the time I said that I hadn't really heard anything that was giving evidence about that, that I hadn't really seen anything in terms of how that would impact black people in the States in terms of them leaving the European Union. They had a segment on News One this week that was talking about that specifically. And they said that they had a basically panel and they asked that question. The consensus seemed to be that they didn't see how or why this would have a specific impact on black people here in the States. They were talking about certainly parallels with Donald Trump and a lot of the same anti-immigrant white supremacist rhetoric that produced that vote. They were certainly drawing a lot of parallels between that. But in terms of a specific economic impact on black people here in the States as a result of the Brexit vote, they did not see anything that would suggest that. Again, folks can pay attention to that as we roll. I'm sure this will be an ongoing story over the next months, years, in terms of how all of this plays out. But I did catch that just within the past couple of days. Also, the report about the black female reporter in Iowa, where it was talking about she and her colleague, they were out reporting. There was a police shooting, and they were attacked by this terroristic white woman. I thought that was important because the man, I guess the people at the station, they were talking about this incident, and they were saying, oh, they, you know, displayed such professionalism. And Emmy Victor, that's the black female's name, she was so professional in how she handled herself, how she dealt with this whole situation, and, you know, we're just really proud. What stood out to me in that segment was He said specifically, they talking about the victims, Emmy Victor and the other colleagues she was with, he said that they were in a difficult, emotionally charged situation. That's a direct quote. In my view, that is another act of racism. We talk so regularly about the deceptive use of words, and not just saying that this was, if you want to say an incident of racism, if you want to say an incident of white supremacy, if you want to use their language, hate crime, whatever, just making it very clear in terms of what they experienced and not trying to minimize and obfuscate what took place. In my view, that happens all the time as it relates to Black people specifically. Even the report where they were talking about the judge in the Stanford rape case, where they brought up what happened with Daniel Holzclaw, which is A+, making sure that people don't forget about that and pay attention to that. He has an appeal file and all that, just making sure that people keep that in the forefront of their mind, what's happening down in Oklahoma. But when they referenced the victims in that case, they said people of color. And in my view, that totally incorrect. We want to be clear about what happened in that case. These were Black females. Black females, 13 at least, could have been more than that, 13 Black females that were raped and sexually terrorized by a law enforcement officer. Be very clear about that every time, particularly calling out Black people that are the victims and not just trying to obfuscate and make it seem like it's all non-white people. But I thought specifically with that reporter, the case of the reporter in Iowa, I thought that was just really not clear use of language. And as I said, could have just been a direct act of racism to just describe it. I think they do that on a regular basis, just describing Black people as emotional or angry or anything that is involving racism, white supremacy just gets chalked up to something that is emotionally charged. I think you even heard some of that with President Obama talking about Black people being angry. Next up, the incident at the church. I said that I had just recently started looking at incidents, just doing searches on a weekly basis for N-word, N-word, and seeing what pops up. I hadn't been doing that before. I would, you know, search for white supremacy or racism or any number of terms, not N-word. I started doing that and found all kinds of stuff just recently, as I said, within the last few months or so, I think just within this calendar year. That report about these two white savages throwing eggs from the vehicle, from the church vehicle, make sure I'm clear, throwing eggs from the church vehicle at Black people and calling them niggers while they're in the church vehicle. And their job is to help Black people who have gotten in some sort of trouble and they're supposed to try to be helping them get their life together. Wow. I was absolutely just floored. I mean, I was listening to the report like, wow, this is crazy. Like, they're out throwing stuff and just terrorizing random Black citizens. And then as it just kept going, that they're in the church van while they're doing this, like, wow. I can only say, once again, make sure that you check to see when they reference, or just check on a regular basis for reports that are dealing with the N-word. I crack up laughing when I hear folks talking about Black people need to stop saying the N-word and all this other nonsense. I'm quite sure that any Black person that you want to pick out, Kanye West, Snoop, Nicki Minaj, any other Black person that you want to pick out, Richard Pryor, I don't think it's their fault. I don't think they are most to blame for these white race soldiers going out and terrorizing Black. I mean, this is just a regular old Black female. She's just trying to catch the bus and go to work and do her thing. And you're just going by and pelting her and calling her a nigga. This is 24/7 terrorism that Black people are subjected to. And I mean, it's just stunning on so many, stunning on so many levels that these are whites that are supposed to be representing God, white Jesus. And this is their conduct. Astounding. Maybe that's one, folks, if you do participate in any sort of church service or what have you, you can perhaps share at the congregation and see what they think. Fascinating report. Definitely encourage folks to check up with the news. Since this weekend is holiday weekend, July 4, as they tell me, I would encourage folks to be safe. I'm saying it at the beginning of the program just because I know that substance abuse is a major issue. That's one of the big ways that whites practice racism, white supremacy, and keeping a lot of us in greater confinement and just making a lot of unnecessary problems for us. Definitely keep that in mind this weekend. I think I said it yesterday. You already know that there are going to be a lot of checkpoints where they have police set up to see, give you a breathalyzer, what have you, and make sure that you are sober for the festivities that are going to be happening this weekend. Keep that in mind. If you are going to make the decision to consume any alcohol or intoxicants or whatever the case may be, man, I would get to one spot and stay there. You do not want to put yourself in a position where you have to be out and about in a vehicle where anything can happen, where you could get stopped by a white person, where they're asking you questions and all this. And it just can get really, really bad quickly. And we've had people come on the program and testify to that before. Just something to keep in mind for this entire week, really any time under the system of white supremacy, but particularly this weekend, the holidays, you know whites are going to be out in full force. Sobriety would be best, but if you can't do that, at least be codified in the way that you, you know, conduct yourself over the next, really, I would think until like Tuesday or Wednesday, because I think they're going to probably assume that folks will be out acting a fool for the next 3-4 days around all this holiday madness. At any rate, and in that vein, I certainly am going to say something about the cannabis legalization in Colorado. I will save that for down the road, but I think someone had talked about that before, so we'll touch on that later on. Just keep that one on the backside for now. The last thing that I'll get in before I get some of the folks who dialed in, and this is not a referendum for theater. I'm not really trying to have a whole lot of discussion about movies and television, things like that. I try to discourage that on the compensatory call-in, but just the same reasoning logic that I employed for people who heard me discuss why I really was not that interested in doing a big analysis of the Roots remake that came out last month. They just have the Free State of Jones coming out, and I had told people that I was seeing the trailers for that movie when Roots was still on. They were showing it on television, they had it playing, and I was just like, man, I mean, I'm supposed to be just inundated with these images of black people being enslaved and brutalized and what have you. That's somehow supposed to help us get a better understanding of racism and U.S. history and all that. That's just not my analysis. I think that racists have a totally separate objective agenda that is not at all related to helping black people or going out of the business of white terrorism. I think they enjoy seeing these images of brutality. The exact same post that I wrote about Roots, you could take Roots out and just insert Free State of Jones and everything would apply, that they just love these sort of things. I think that they have the good white person, the white savior element in this movie. I obviously haven't seen it and do not encourage anyone to go see it, to spend a nickel, a shilling on going to see this production. But more and more to come. They got The Good Lord Bird coming down the road, which is another slave flick, and The Birth of a Nation, which is coming out down the road. Just going to be inundated with these more and more and more. And I think they have an objective with all of that. Certainly The Purge coming out this weekend. No coincidence at all. A franchise that is notorious for promoting whites having fun, stalking, hunting, killing, butchering black people. That would be the film that they release on July 4 weekend. The Purge, election year. And from the reviews that I've read, that they just make it very explicit, very blatant what this is about in terms of white supremacy and whites wanting, looking forward, being happy. I think we said that consistently. Whites kill for fun. Them looking forward, gleefully enjoying hunting and killing black people. Even that word, I think the hunting aspect of it, to make a sport out of stalking black people. I will stop there. As I said, I for sure am going to have a word about the situation in Colorado with the cannabis legalization. And lo and behold, who's still getting arrested even after it's been legalized? We'll hit the phone lines. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you could watch the background noise, that would be super appreciated. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could hit your mute button, that would be great. You can just unmute whenever you, you know, have a comment that you want to make sure you interject or whatever the case may be, and then mute yourself. Just adds a lot of distortion if you've got people talking in the background, or if they've got a device, television or radio or whatever, on making noise. We can pick all that stuff up. So just use your mute button. Again, compensatory call in. I request no metaphors. I have never said not to use metaphors at all. What I have consistently said, and only for a short period of time, very recently I started doing this, no metaphors on this program, the compensatory call-in, reason, explanation. As we just discussed this week with the metaphor involving Rosa Parks, it's been my observation. I have concluded in an unambiguous manner, when people start talking about racism, that's whites and or victims of racism, frequently metaphors are used that are not accurate. They are comparing two things that are not equivalent at all. I think whites do this a lot to practice racism, just to obfuscate things so that we don't get accurate information. We don't get clarity in understanding what racism is, how it works. That's why you see a lot of these metaphors where they are comparing racism with gay rights and what they call homophobia and all of that. I think this is done deliberately by whites frequently. I think a lot of times non-white people, victims of racism, we in our confusion and just trying to get a grasp of how to articulate, speak about racism, and just trying to understand this concept, I think sometimes we employ metaphors and are just still trying to figure out that sometimes the metaphors that we're using are not the best, they're not clear, they're not accurate, that we could do a better job in how we convey our thoughts, ideas, suggestions, concepts related to racism, white supremacy, and or counter-racism. So for this program, no metaphors, and I would encourage any time, really all the time, you should really pay attention to the type of metaphors that people use, because I'm telling you, frequently, folks are using these and they're just not accurate. If the major tool of racism, white supremacy is deception, metaphors, that is the package that the deception is going to be presented in on a regular basis. Right on. With that, the folks who dialed in who have a hand up should be with us. If you have comments you would like to share, feel free.
Go ahead, ma'am. Is that female?
Yes.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay, thank you very much. I just wanted to make a comment. I don't know if this has been discussed before about this light skin, dark skin thing this people have been talking about, supposed to be going around in the so-called black community. I think white folks have started this mess. I noticed it when LeBron James team won, as opposed to Stephen Curry. They were making black people were making derogative comments about Stephen Curry being light-skinned, and light-skinned people didn't know how to play ball and stuff like that. And I made comments that I don't think black people should be talking like this. This is racially divisive. We are all black. We're all treated the same. It doesn't matter if Stephen Curry has blue eyes and light skin. He's still black. And then they started doing it again after Jesse Williams made his speech at the BET Awards. They were saying, oh, well, Jesse can do that because he's got light skin. He's got a white mother and he's got blue eyes and all that. And it just makes me mad when I know whites are the ones that start these comments, but black people get caught up in this mess, and it makes me angry when I see this, like Oprah having a show called Dark Girls and then another one called Light Girls and stuff like that. And I think that's something that we really, really, really need to stop, because it is it's ultimate foolishness. And it's just another way to divide us. And that's all I wanted to say for now. Thank you.
Greetings, everyone. I was wondering before I state on what I was going to say, did anybody else heard Mr. Fuller's comments on gender confusion on this program? I believe it's on Wednesdays. Yeah, on this past Wednesday. Okay. I thought it was kind of profound, which is not unusual for Mr. Fuller. It made me have to think about it deeply. Now, I'm probably going to mess it up because I can't be Mr. Fuller. But basically, what he was saying is the – and somebody correct me if I say it incorrectly – the new vagina would be the white male's anus, which the way I interpreted on what he was saying was that the tool of confusion that white people who practice racism is going to be so proficient. It is being so proficient that it actually is going to further confuse a generation of non-white black people, males in particular. In this particular case, he was talking, what he's referring to, black males in particular, what he's referring to whereas we develop a very non-constructive interest into anti-sexual behavior. Now, I can see that. I can see what he's saying is happening just from the standpoint of you can look at some of the precursors to it, which is wearing your pants down your butt, which is actually derived partially. It may not be fully, but partially derived from a prison greater confinement invitation that males do in code with other males in greater confinement. And you have a lot of young black males who copy this behavior, and a lot of them haven't even stepped foot in greater confinement, but yet they do it. So I can see that as a possibility and what he's talking about. And I'm still turning it over in my head, but it sounds like something that is very logical, coming from a very logical point of view, because it is I see it myself as far as the white supremacists using that type of behavior, that type of anti-sexual behavior, to influence non-white black people. And they're getting quite proficient at it. In other words, hey, male, female, that's kind of old. Let's add some more initials to the I can't even name all of them now. LGBT, whatever. But anyway, I can't even mention all of them. But let's add some more initials to that sexual confusion, gender confusion titles. And so I can partway see what he's talking about with that. That's all I'll say right now, and I have some more things to talk about, but that's all I say right now. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to everybody. Good evening to Gus. Good evening to all of the listeners. This is V from Central New York, right outside of Syracuse. And it's been a while. I haven't been able to catch a live show in, man, probably almost a month now. So it feels good to be with you all tonight. Sorry to kind of pivot on the topic that was discussed. I have one quick comment about Mr. Barack Obama. and then some suggested reading, actually. I really don't have any comments about what he said, because I'm used to kind of hearing that, not only from him, but from other people who are kind of in positions like him. A couple of weeks ago, somebody posted online on Facebook a video from the rapper RZA, R-Z-A, who is now working apparently on Wall Street. And I watched the video, and basically the video said the same thing, that black people need to pull up their pants, they need to get their minds right, and that's how they're going to make it. As a person with what I like to call an economically challenged background, to constantly, consistently hear the shaming doesn't really do much for me anymore. And I realize that a lot of young black people, it just makes them angry. And they just basically say, okay, I don't need you, go away. On a better note, actually, on that same note, and then I'll get to the better note, Dr. King, I've been studying Dr. King for about 4 or 5 years, and as part of my studying, I've been looking for kind of off-the-beaten-path speeches. And ironically, possibly ironically, I sometimes wonder if it's purposeful, but over the last couple of years, there have been a couple of really huge Dr. King speech discoveries. And one of those discoveries, the title of the speech is called Summer of Our Discontent. This speech actually became a chapter in his book, Why We Can't Wait. And it's very pertinent to today, and particularly to what Mr. Obama said, because in the speech, Dr. King talks about JFK dragging his feet, pardon me, that's a metaphor, acting slowly in actually fulfilling his promises to black people in the civil rights demands that they had, and how basically throughout the entire JFK administration, very little was done. And then towards the end, he started making moves towards, okay, fulfilling those promises. And then, of course, we all know Lyndon Johnson kind of took over that mantle. But on a much happier note, I was walking to work the other day, and this young man, of course, summertime, was walking ahead of me, and I said hi to him, and he stops and start walking with him and ask him what does he think about school. He loves school. He loves being educated. He loves reading. He loves being engaged in that way. And he wanted to be an artist because you can be artistic. So I said to him, my father was an architect. And as an architect, you can be artistic beyond your heart's desire, but you also get to see your creations come to life. And this young man said, I like that idea. And so that really lifted my heart. As for the reading, a couple of books. One just came out, and another one is about to come out. The first one is called White Trash, and it is basically a 400-year history or overview of a history of whiteness. And the second one is called White Rage, which is, from the description, about the constant pushback or the constant political pushback, honestly, that black people have consistently had to endeavor whenever they tried to move forward. Those two came to my attention today. I have not read either one of the books. And finally, a suggestion for all of your libraries. I am a major dictionary collector. I love dictionaries, and I use them probably daily. And I have 5 of them that I'd like to suggest that if you can get your hands on them, to definitely do so. The first one is a 2-volume set. You can download it online. It is the 1828 Noah Webster original. You can get it from archive.org, and it is a very, very stunning dictionary, especially when you really start looking up words and their original meanings and their original context. It'll definitely open up your mind. The second dictionary is from 1966. I specifically say 1970 or before because then pop culture started really intruding on it. But Random House. So 1970 or before. The third set, which is a little bit harder to come by, but you can find them. The 1950 version of Funks and Wagnall, W-A-G-N-A-L-L dictionary. And you can actually download this online now. The Oxford 17 volume set of dictionary books. And finally, the Black Law Dictionary. Every black home actually should have one of those. The Black Law Dictionary. Specifically before 1970s end, but definitely before 1980. That'll be all. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from, anybody that we have not heard from, if you had commentary you wanted to make sure you share, feel free. Line should be open if you have a hand up.
Hello. Gus, I was wondering if, I know a lot of black, I've heard a lot of black guests come on your show and use the term agency. Have you, I don't know if people, a lot of the black people that call in have like a, sort of like a law definition of agency. Do you ever ask them if they understand it, like the term, like fundamentally, like what is an agency relationship?
No. Generally, the context, I'm trying to think of the most recent time. I think the most recent context that I can recall is somebody using the term agency on the program. It was around sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people. I think the black female that we had on from South Africa last weekend, where she was saying that she was talking about me, I was taking away agency from the black person who's engaged in these tragic arrangements. And my general response when it comes up in that context now is I don't really want to get bogged down into what they mean when they say agency and all of that in that context. I generally just get to the general point is either we have non-white people that are confused about racism or we don't. Either we have non-white people who do not have an accurate grasp of what racism is, how it works, and how we should be conducting ourselves in relationship with whites, or we don't. It's not even like just hopping over that for that context, but in terms of just overall asking what they mean in a legal sense, what does agency mean? I don't think that's not a procedure that I've generally engaged in. Did you want to share if you had the definition in a legal sense that you wanted to share?
I heard it in, well, I got it in my, in like a law business course, but I can't remember the exact definition, but the main point is that, like, an agency relationship, the best example of it is between an employer and an employee, where the employee is an agent and the employer is the principal. And there's certain rules governing that relationship, but it's really a master-slave kind of relationship. So I don't know if people, I think a lot of people use the term because I think maybe it was introduced to them this, and they think that they understand it in the larger context, but it's really full of error, I would say. But, I mean, you're right. I mean, we don't really need to bug. I was just wondering, like, what was your sense in terms of people understanding it?
for sure. It's very popular in academic circles. I think anybody that's listening to the program, if you take any class, particularly if you take any classes where they're talking about what they call social justice, if they're actually going to be talking about white supremacy, or if they're going to be talking about any other sorts of issues, talking about producing justice between people, that word is going to pop up in terms of people having agency or not having it, or how they exercise their quote-unquote agency. And I think in that sense, often at least what people, my interpretation of it is meaning that you have some level of power. You might not be the most powerful person in the situation, but you have some amount of individual power where you are able to do some things and you're able to exercise your power, your will, however limited it might be in some capacity. That's generally what they mean. Just in my view, just kind of going back to what I said before, our agency, our will, in my view, is generally compromised because we don't have an accurate understanding of racism. So we're not making correct decisions. We're not exerting the limited power that we have under this system in the best manner because we just don't have an accurate grasp of what racism is and how it works. That's why in the context of the sexual relationship, that's a great example right there where I think pretty much all of us would have the will, would have at least enough power to say, no, I'm not going to have sex with a white person. But we don't use our power in that department in the most correct manner because we don't have an accurate understanding of racism. That even, I think, goes back to retired firefighter's point. I could be in error.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, yeah. I also just wanted to, with your recent guests from South Africa, I can't remember the white gentleman's name, but I did listen to Simamkele Lekabu, and I've spent a lot of my time in that part of the world. I was actually born in that part of the world, and I thought the white gentleman, I think everything about him was I concluded from listening that everything about him was a lie. Even his accent, like I concluded that he had deliberately changed his accent to like a South African accent, because I think if you reach a certain age, it's extremely difficult to lose your accent. And everything that he was saying, from when he was calling, like, where they place black people, when he was calling it the township, and he was describing it as a township, but it's, no one in South Africa calls it a township. It's the, in English, they call it the location in Afrikaans, or Buddha, they just call it the lokasi. So it's just a location. So just, even like the finer, smaller things that he was talking, not even just the larger, like everything that he was saying was just full of lies and races. And I read and I listened to some of his comments, but I was just like, everything about him was completely racist. But I think, what is it, Mr. Kavu, I think that for most people from that part of the world, even she's pretty far ahead than like a large of the population in terms of understanding what's going on. Most people are just, I mean, it's, the poverty is just so deep and so, like, it's, yeah, well, the racism, and I didn't use those terms. But, yeah, I definitely appreciate you getting, like, the international guests and us getting, like, a global view of what's going on. So thank you for that. I'll mute my line.
For sure. World problem. They do a lot of the same consistent thing, even down to the phoniness and the deception. That is for sure a central element worldwide. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you doubt, if you have a hand up, you should be with us.
Good evening, everyone. It's Carmen. A couple of things. The thing about the unrest in Europe, I think I crashed the computer where it said they did study after study and they found that 7.25% of black people causes white people, will always cause white people to want to leave. And if they feel like they're at home, then they need you to leave. So 7.25% is the tipping point. I noticed that's when Europe started getting really hostile towards immigrants. But and that's all it is. I mean, it's nothing else other than that thing. And I wish I understood where the biological significance of 7.25%. But, you know, when I watch it in real life, it really holds up. And the other thing, I'm starting to realize that, I know I'm probably last on this, but I'm starting to realize that they really are like locusts. They just deplete. Now that I'm seeing it where I live, because, you know, it's a large population of black people, so we haven't depleted our resources here. And so white people are coming in going, oh, my goodness, look at all of these resources. Look at this lovely river and all of this land and, you know, this sparsely populated. And oh, they just love it. They love it. But they're like locusts. They just clear-cut everything. I mean, they just come in, they strip all the trees, they deplete the soil, they just go from place to place, and when they run out of resources, then they start a war with the nearest neighbor so that they can, you know, get fat and happy again from looting. And that's how they live their lives. That's how they stay good, by just looting, going from people to people, place to place, looting. I don't know where that came from, but I think that the poisoning of the children, of course, in Flint, Michigan, is deliberate. It's deliberate. It's an experiment. We'll run it out for 40 or 50 years. My God, we have to wait until all of these poisoned children grow up so we can document every anomalous thing that happens to them. We're going to chart every marriage, every miscarriage. Oh, this is the biggest study ever. They're never going to let this stop. They're never going to let these people come out from under lead poisoning. It is a wonderfully trapped population that they can run a long-term study on. They'll never stop. And then the sheriff's trying to build a new jail where we live. So I called Ms. Michelle Alexander, who wrote Jim Crow. And I forget the subtitle, the new Jim Crow, but I forget the subtitle. But she said to me that, I said I would follow up. It's here. Hi, Karma. Michelle sends her appreciations and thanks for your invitation. Unfortunately, she has declined the opportunity as her schedule is full this year. Our apologies and best wishes. Rhonda Walker, assistant to Michelle Alexander. So now I still need someone to let the people know where I live, that we probably shouldn't allow them to build this giant prison in the middle of our homes. If somebody can help me with that, I would appreciate it. I need a speaker. That's it. Thank you.
Seems like that. I thought Thomas in New York had said last week, I don't know if you checked with Scotty Reed, but he had said that that's one of the big things that they do. He might know some speakers. And since you're in Texas, Robert, I don't know if you would prefer a white person or a black person to come, but I was thinking Robert Perkinson might be someone you can, since he's white, certainly he is a suspected race soldier, so you can evaluate his work. But I know he was a guest on the program. He wrote the book Texas Tough, where he talks about how the prison empire in Texas specifically, how the history of that influences how prisons are run throughout the nation. And he goes back over like the last 150 years and he talks about a lot of the same parallels in terms of new Jim Crow and how the prison system, that was the new way or the more refined way to continue enslavement of black people, and just the various aspects of how white supremacy played out explicitly and all of that. And again, how that influences how all of the prisons in this part of the world look today, 2016, Robert Perkinson. But he was on the program in 2016, and I'd have to double check where he's a professor at, but I know his book is specifically about prisons in Texas.
Well, I certainly will write Mr. Perkinson, but I certainly would have preferred a black person, but I will write Mr. Perkinson because someone has to tell my neighbors what's going on in a way that they can hear and listen to. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Reed, you might have some, excuse me, Mr. Reed might know some black people as well. I mean, it seems like there would be a lot of people, a lot of black people that would be good to get to talk about that subject matter who've been studying it. I'll ponder myself. I'll drop you an email if I can think of some folks that I might recommend that might be good to invite.
Okay. Thank you.
Ooh. Other folks have commentary? If we have not heard from you, you should get your hand up if you had comments you wanted to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. There was that one segment, I think it was about a firefighter. Would you happen to know what area of the world that was in, or what state or whatnot, Gus?
I believe that was in Massachusetts. I will double check to make sure, but because I think he was upset and saying that these Negroes that were doing this party, that they were uppity Boston folks who were, you know, not cooperating or doing what they were supposed to do having this party. But I think it was in Massachusetts. I'll double check.
Oh, okay, okay. Because I was thinking about something along the lines of a topic like that about, I think the term is used, arson, of the racists a long time ago. And I think they still do it now to homes and churches. And that was just one way that they would mistreat and terrorize black people. And it just goes to show you, like, I think Mr. Fuller spoke on it once about how we internalize and somewhat normalize the things that have been done to us, like using certain words in our songs and making it into phrases and stuff. And like, I think it was on that, like, I know it's a movie, but it was on that House Party movie when they was chanting "The roof is on fire," and, you know, and it makes you think, like, you know, dang, I wonder where they could have got that from. And, you know, I think, in my opinion, that came from racism, you know, and just for him to make that kind of post like that, you know, it just really showed his true nature. And I think it was another one about the police officers, and this might have been like a segment on a news show where the I think that might have been a white female that said, well, you know, the only real color that matters is blue. And, you know, we just, and one of the guys said, you know, they should hire more non-white officers and things like that. And she was saying, well, you know, they already do. And some of them participated in the implicit bias. Like, I think they're using that term to make racism applicable to non-whites as well. So, like, I never really heard nobody ask, like, what's, you know, what's the definition for that term? Like, an implicit bias. Like, has there ever been, like, some kind of person, like, challenge that term? Like, ask somebody to define that, Gus?
I think that segment was on News One, and even the first segment about the firefighter, it was in Massachusetts, in Freetown, Massachusetts, no less. At any rate, that segment where they were talking about the implicit bias, and that now they're going to have the Department of Justice, they're going to have racial bias testing or implicit bias testing. I think at the beginning of that segment on News One, they did give a definition for racial bias, but it just, what stood out to me, in addition to the point that you're making about how this becomes where it is not exclusive to whites, that everybody, white people and non-white people, have some sort of racial bias or implicit racial bias. But it also, they really spent a lot of time belaboring that this is not explicit racial bias. This is not whites who are just looking to go out and abuse and harm black people. This is where they just aren't aware. They're just not conscious. They have these buried thoughts or ideas or concept or racial ways of thinking, and it just comes out in their behavior unbeknownst to them. That I felt like they really invested a lot of words and time to make that point so that you don't think that whites are doing this deliberately.
That's very very interesting how they can deflect the conversation. And I think, like what you mentioned a while ago about after the Orlando shooting, how system is going to keep promoting the notion that, hey, you know, this is happening to the LGBT community, or, you know, we're going to make this conversation about gay rights and things like that. And, you know, so I can just imagine that they're going to put in, hey, you know, it's not just reasons of racism. It's got to be sexual considerations and whatever, you know, terms that they'll come up with just to cause more confusion. So, but black people are still being called niggers and things like that by people who were white people who call themselves gay, and, you know, just going to intensify the confusion. And
oh, was that it, or did you have more that you were going to share, sir?
Oh, I was done. You can go to the next caller.
Oh, right on, right on. Yeah, I generally don't hear people get questioned about the racial, either for definition, that people just come out and present that. And I think that's one of the more acceptable ways that you can talk about racism, white supremacy, so that no white person gets directly indicted for their conduct. And the same thing, everybody, it's not just whites, it's everybody has racial bias, implicit bias, however they want to put it together. And this problem can be solved with trans. And it's the same logic that generally gets employed, that because they're ignorant, the same gets, all of this goes back to white people are ignorant about racism. Since they're ignorant, since they're not aware, since it's implicit, since it's unconscious, we can just get them some training. We'll do a seminar. We'll bring in Jane Elliott. We'll bring in Timothy Wise, and we'll have this thing licked in no time. That's consistently the way it gets presented, and that all of that just serves the system of racism, white supremacy, just more refinement. And again, more confusion in the way that we think non-white people, victims of racism, how we think about what it means to be white, and how racism, white supremacy operates, thinking that somehow this problem is connected to whites just not being informed. And nothing could be further from the truth. They are super informed. And the folks riding around, even in fact with the fire incident, you could take either one, the racists riding around in the church van throwing eggs at black people, this black female at the bus stop, and they said they think it was, she was not the only victim, or the firefighter incident. We have read, I was going back, I think it was in Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, where race terrorists, white terrorists, went and deliberately burned black property, residence or black business. They deliberately set it on fire, and then when the fire trucks came and they tried to put the fire out, they put holes in the fire hose. We covered that on this program. I think it also might have been, I think I have heard this numerous times, where racists went and set some black property on fire, and either the racists also operated the fire trucks, so they just would not go put the fire out, or when the fire trucks did arrive and they tried to put it out, they put holes in the fire hose so that they couldn't put it out or attack the fire. I mean, this has happened over and over and over. That sort of commentary, in my view, that sort of thing should not just get explained as implicit bias or he didn't know, he just had a stressful day and was frustrated. I think they do that sort of thing all the time, where they minimize just direct white dedication to white terrorism. That's just what it is. Be explicit, be accurate about it, as opposed to, you know, trying to lie about things, and always to the benefit of whites, where we minimize their sadistic racist conduct. And that church incident, I just go back to it, that stood out for me quite a bit this week. That would be another one. These are whites that are supposed to be helping black people. That's their job. We're supposed to go in and help these black people who have gotten in trouble with the law in some way, shape, or form. We're supposed to help them. And while we are in our capacity on the job, we're riding around in our employee vehicle, the church van, no less. And this is what we're doing on our time. It's just amazing representation of what it means to be white. And again, this is not ignorance. This is what they're thinking about all the time. consciously, deliberately, you cannot be white and be ignorant about racism should be no surprise. I even had suspicion for the whites who hired them that they were so stunned and shocked that this sort of thing could happen. Like, really? Other folks who dialed in who had a hand up, do you all have commentary you wanted to get in? Folks are lollygagging, not sure what the issue is. Again, we do have a lot of spectators. I say that for the workplace racism segment and this one. I say that for these two programs specifically because neither of those two programs are designed for spectators. They're not designed for people to just dial in and sit and listen. This program was designed specifically for all the people who have said over the years that in studying racism, white supremacy, they have not had folks to talk to and that they would like the opportunity to be able to exchange views or thoughts with other victims of racism, ask questions, or just things that they've been thinking about. That's the whole reason for this forum to exist, and certainly the same thing with the Workplace Racism Forum. And as I've said consistently, we'll have 40 people, 40, 50 people just on the phone. That's not even counting the people that are listening online or whatever, listening to the archives. And most of them do not participate. If you dialed in, you should be looking for an opportunity to participate. If you have observations, things that you've seen over the last week, whatever the case may be, to share. Certainly for workplace racism, it should be hard to have a whole lot of black people silent about that as though we are not experiencing trouble on the job. But I will leave that for Thursday. While we're seeing if other folks have anything they wanted to share, as I said, I certainly had commentary about the situation in Colorado. I'm not into the, trying to the one time that I get something correct in terms of an assessment about racism, white supremacy, that's not while we're still under the system of white terrorism to jump up and down and be like, oh, I think I got one thing correct. But I do think this is extremely important as they have been devoting so much time over the last 3 years, I would say, to cannabis legalization and doing all these studies, having people like Michelle Alexander, who is a victim of white supremacy, coming out and saying we need to legalize, that this would help, and racism has been such an aspect, which I'm not denying, that racism has been such a huge part of the what they call war on drugs, and this will help stop some of that problem. Even a sizable chunk of you all, Cal's listeners, taking the same position. I said rather confidently, I see no evidence that whites are going out of the business of locking up niggers. I do not care what laws they change as it relates to drugs. I'm not surprised at all that now you're having this large number of young black people, black children. I think they said blacks and Latinos, which I don't use that phrase, but non-white young people being locked up in Colorado, even though cannabis has been legalized. I'm not surprised about that at all. That is a trend that I would expect to continue as they go along with this campaign of legalizing cannabis and maybe everything, as I've been seeing more mainstream reports of late saying we need to legalize all drugs. But I'm not surprised about that at all. That is certainly one, in my view, everybody who has been commenting on this and lobbying and saying that this will somehow help black people, that this will somehow mitigate against the effects of racism, white supremacy in the criminal justice system, this should definitely be a report that gets filed and analyzed. I would expect more of the same. I don't think that that is going to be an anomaly in how this is enforced. I can say from Washington State, for the people, because it seemed like we had a sizable number of people where they had some sort of trouble with law enforcement around cannabis specifically. They were in a vehicle. I can say for Washington State, they made the penalties if you're in a vehicle in possession of cannabis even stiffer once they legalized it. If you're under the influence, that's treated just like a DUI. You can use your lose your driver's license in addition to whatever other penalties they want to hash out. If that means you get some prison time, then, you know, that's what it's going to be as well. In addition to, even if you are not under the influence, just having it in your possession in a vehicle, they refined the statute. It has to be in a sealed container if it's going to be in your vehicle. If it's not in a sealed container, it has to be in a trunk, the trunk of your vehicle. If it's in like a bag or some sort of container, even a jar where you can just unscrew and screw the top back on, that is a violation, and they can, you know, prosecute you on that as well. So I would just, again, encourage there should be a lot of research, a lot of study, and great skepticism around any claims that legalizing cannabis is going to somehow alleviate the problem of racism, white supremacy. And I would be remiss in saying I think many of the folks that people have some reverence for in terms of their views on racism, white supremacy, Dr. Kamban, Dr. Francis Kress Welsing, Neely Fuller Jr., Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Dr. Niana Rasayan, I believe they all were in consensus in saying that they too did not see where this was going to solve any of the problems for racism, white supremacy, that there was probably a hidden white agenda that was not going to benefit black people. I will pause there. The person that dialed in, 0613, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to the host, callers, and the listeners. I just wanted to chime in quickly about the clip that you was just commenting on. I find it very interesting just that while cannabis is legal in certain states, just, you know, a few states over, people still being locked up for it. The whole thing of it to me is ridiculous. But what I really wanted to speak on, I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it's one of the, I guess statistically they're saying it's one of the worst places for black people to be right now. My observation, it seems that the level of anger and agitation amongst the black people is at an all-time high in this particular part where I'm at. And it seems not just in my observation, but in other people's observation as well, it seems that the younger black females are getting more angry and more agitated. They're people saying like, man, you know, the females, man, you know, worse is the boys, you know, right now. I just wanted to put that out there. And I was just coming back in from a little outing with the family and got some pretty bad stuff. Not one black female, but two black females in the same establishment. And, you know, I had to practice being patient with them. And I think I did okay. And I'll meet my line. Thanks for taking the call.
Awesome. 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 That is patience with other black people. I recommend that all the time, all the time. That will be super needed because the system of white supremacy does produce a lot of frustration for black people. And a lot of times we do end up taking our frustrations out on other black people. But outstanding, you were able to exercise a little bit of patience in how you dealt with them. In terms of you're sensing some level of frustration or anger amongst younger black people in your part of Wisconsin specifically. I think number one, they've done reports like all over the world that Wisconsin locks up more black people than anywhere, like proportion, like just based on the numbers of black people that are the population in Wisconsin versus the number of black people that are in confinement, that it is like astronomical. I didn't even know that there were a whole lot of black people in Wisconsin specifically, but that is one. And then two, I know there have been quite a few incidents in Wisconsin just over the last couple of years. Corey Stingley, the teenage 16-year-old black child who was killed. He was allegedly shoplifting, and just three random. These weren't even enforcement officials. These were just white brute citizens who strangled him to death. And no indictment. I think it was Tony Robinson, if I'm remembering correctly, non-white male who was shot and killed. And same thing, no indictment. So there have been quite a few of these public incidents of police terrorism against black people, specifically non-white people. And it's not even all police terrorism, just regular white citizen terrorism as well in Wisconsin. So I would not be surprised at all seeing that. And in addition to everything else that has been happening, but right in your area, seeing that happening and the worthlessness of black life, even black children's lives, in addition to the might of white terrorism, I can totally understand how that would drive up levels of frustration, probably for not just in your area, probably nationally, internationally, for black people. And unfortunately, I know Dr. Welsing said this a lot of times, we get frustrated, that frustration gets turned to other black people. So it's not a surprise at all. And maybe that can be something else that we're thinking about in terms of how to deal with that, ways to go out and try to reach younger people. So that they can understand what is causing their frustration and then things that we can do to try to solve some of our problems. But I would not be surprised at all to see a rise in the anger amongst young black people, just black people, period, not just young black people. Other folks have commentary? Even if you already dialed in, if you had other things that you wanted to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, guys, this is me again. I wanted to point out it was another part in the audio segment where, like, I'm noticing this trend where victims of racism are pointing out when they are being victimized, they are making commentary on the response to bystanding white people. And saying, well, you know, they just looked so shocked, and or they just didn't do anything at all, you know. And when they're using that term implicit, you know, like, hey, you know, they aren't ignorant, you know, they are participating in the act right there. But, you know, when you're still kind of confused, not able to really clarify or make clear what that is, and it's taking place right there before you. And I'm starting to notice that black people, non-white people are pointing that out, the participation, I will say, of other white people that are in that environment, and they are not stepping in to confront the perpetrator, you know? And like I just wanted to point that out as well. And that's all I have.
Great point. I think that happened right here. The clip from Seattle a few weeks ago, where it was a black male and a black female. They were in a Starbucks, and some white terrorists came up and spit on them and were calling them niggers and all this stuff. And I think they said the same thing because they were in Seattle, period. You stop right there. So, of course, they're going to be around a whole lot of white people. But they said that they didn't do anything. The patrons in the coffee shop, that they just sat around. Nobody said anything. Nobody. I think they said maybe one white woman got up and alerted the manager as to what had taken place. But I mean, it was a lot of people there, and they just said the vast majority of the white folks just went about their business, enjoying their lattes and eating their scones or whatever else that they were doing, staying on their mobile devices. And I think the same thing for the clip from the UK where the victim of racism, she was a reporter, and she was saying that she was being terrorized. This, you know, race soldier came up and was calling her a nigger and all this other stuff, and they just observed and kept right on rolling. And I think that too. I think exactly that, in terms of seeing that, recognizing it, articulate, like, you're aware, yes, other white people are walking by and they're seeing this and they're not doing anything. But I don't think, as you articulated, I don't think that typical victims are recognizing that itself as an act of white supremacy. When you see these other racists practicing racism, terrorizing, abusing black people, non-white people, and you don't do anything, that right there is your, and I mean, that's not implicit bias. That's not, I'm not aware. I am aware. I'm seeing it right there. Oh, yeah, she's calling her a nigger. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, well, going about my, time to go get a coffee. Time to go get a coffee. And I just keep going about my business as a white person. That right there is an act of racism. And that's happening all the time. White people are seeing, observing other whites practicing racism all the time. And they do nothing. They do not intervene. They don't speak up. It happens all the time. And I even think in our, the way we've been conditioned as victims, I think a lot of times that we find a way to rationalize that when these whites observe these acts of terrorism and they don't do anything. We say, well, they just were overwhelmed like I was, because if I had been in their position, I wouldn't have known what to do. I would have been, you know, overwhelmed too. I think that's how a lot of us, we rationalize it, and not just, yes, there was one racist who attacked me directly, and then there were other racists who just abetted. They did nothing. You know, if this had been any other crime, if this had been a bank robbery, if this had been a burglary, they would have intervened. I know whites have certainly had no problem calling the police just when they have seen me or any other Negro in an area. They said, oh, wait a minute, suspicious Negro, I've got to call the authorities. I have seen that happen over and over and over and over. Why is it when you observe a direct act of white terrorism, would it be, oh, I don't feel the need to intervene? Great point. Great point, in my opinion. The folks that called in, 6241. 6241, did you have commentary you wanted to add?
Yeah, be heard.
Your volume is kind of low, if you could speak up.
Can you hear me better now?
That is an improvement.
Okay. Good night to the host and to all the callers. I just wanted to chime in on that point right there. What I've noticed a lot on my job, I work in a school, in a middle school, and often, like when things would happen, you know, among staff or with a student, so it's a majority non-white black school, and white teachers cover for each other a lot. Like you know, there's been issues with teachers coming late to what they call power up in the morning. Like we gather in a circle, middle school and elementary. And we have to be there for 7 o'clock in the morning. And here's the director. I'm appointed a white person to make note of anyone who is not there at seven in the circle. Like, even if you're in the building, if you're not in the circle, I believe she marks you as not being there. But this white person, she covers for like white teachers who you know routinely don't come to power up, and yeah, you know, she doesn't do that for like the black teachers. I actually received an email about a couple of us, you know, because, you know, some of us non-white black teachers, then we'll talk about, you know, things that happened or whatever. So a few of us received emails about being tardy a few minutes for power up. But, yeah, that's just what I've noticed. White people cover for each other all the time, especially when they're practicing racism. Thank you.
Great point.
Because I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
If I could, I just wanted to ask, what state are you in? The caller that just spoke. Yes, can you repeat that? I was just asking, what state are you in?
Oh, I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Okay. And then as far as the observation that you had about the white teacher observing and looking out on the time for the other white teachers, how long have you been observing that?
Well, it started, the director implemented this policy around, I would say, September of last year.
Okay.
Or not? Yeah, or maybe October. September, October of last year.
Okay.
So we can ask with the school year with like that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, no, I was asking because I am connected to a teacher in the Wisconsin area, and it seems as though the supervisors or the whoever is the authorities at the school system here, it seems as if they're not paying attention to what time the teachers are arriving, but I don't agree with that. So that's why I was asking the question. Thank you.
Okay. Well, in my school, they just pretty much they ignore it, you know. And one other situation is, because I complained about it, I complained about it about this one particular teacher that's on my team, on my grade level team, and she apparently she was given an accommodation to come late every day, because she has missed power up every day for the entire school year. And we live in the same area. Like we live about 30 minutes outside of Orleans Parish, in another parish. So we have the longest commute. But she was given the accommodation to come late. You know, she comes to school at like 9 o'clock. You know, the children get there at 8, but you know, she comes to school at like 9 o'clock, 9:30. And she actually got a promotion for the next year coming. I saw her during summer school, and she told me she got a promotion. I've heard from some other victims that she posted it up on her Facebook. You know, white people love to brag about the privileges and flexing their white power and things like that. And you know, but it's just interesting. You know, all right, the director of the school is a non-white, non-black male. He's classified. I guess he's classified as Indian. What they would say, Indian. But he's fairly not to use the word fair, but he's light skinned. But yeah, you can say he's fair skinned. But he's not black. And thank you.
There was somebody else that called in. Just make sure he did say he didn't want to say fair. I definitely discourage. That's my suggestion, that we not refer to anyone as having fair skin. Just there are many, many white supremacist connotations to the term fair, a term that we use to describe beauty, a term that is used to describe justice or reasonableness, and a term that is used to describe whiteness. Sometimes it is conflating, or I won't even say whiteness, white. I also discourage the term whiteness as well, but that will have to be for another time. But just where white ends up being conflated with justice and reasonableness and beauty, I just go with the person is pale or melanin deficient. Any of those terms would work. Any of those terms, in my view, would be much better than fair for describing skin color, suggesting only even certain people with a lack of melanin are worthy of just treatment. The person that dialed in 2960, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Evening, Princess.
Good evening. I'm just listening now because I just dialed in, so I didn't know what you guys were discussing.
Compensatory call-in, so people are sharing their views, observations. I suspect you did not hear the audio clips at the beginning of the program, so folks are commenting on that as well. And then just other things. The previous caller was just talking about some of his observations on the job. I think the general point was that whites, they tend to another way that whites practice racism is by covering for other racists. When they are mistreating a black person, there will be another white person who will intervene to make sure that they don't get in trouble, or they will not, you know, contact enforcement officials to stop the mistreatment, or if they just see another white person doing something that's incorrect. The previous caller was talking about white educators coming to work late, probably white women, I suspect. I think he was saying white women, since 70% of the educators in public schools in this part of the world are white women, that they come to school late routinely, and this just doesn't seem to be a problem, and that it seems that other white women, I suspect, are covering for this, their tardiness, where it seems unlikely that that would be happening for black people. I did want to point out really quick as well. Yeah, I did want to point out really quick, and then Princess, if you have anything, or if you want to wait until you kind of get caught up on where the discussion is. I've seen this where whites, they cover for white strangers. It's not just whites covering for their pal on the job or their family member. I've seen whites do this for total strangers that they do not know at all, either where they see them practicing racism and they don't report it to the proper authorities, or they are aware of their wrongdoing or what have you, and they will aid and abet in them being able to get away with that just because this is this person is white. I've seen that on a regular basis as well, which is just a part and parcel of being a part of the white race. I just wanted to get in quick as well. The report that was in the news clips about the former firefighter in Massachusetts who was talking about he was going to let the – he hoped that the black house caught on fire and that he was going to make sure he didn't find the hydrant to put the fire out. When they were talking about him being disciplined, it seemed like the focus of his misconduct was he violated our social media policy, not he was practicing racism and the reprehensible things that he said about blacks. It seemed like it was, we got a social media policy. You can't say incendiary things on social media. So unfortunately, you're going to have to lose your job. It was not, and this is a pattern I think we've talked about before, where the focus of the infraction is not, oh man, you're practicing racism, Jane. You're practicing racism, Todd. We can't have that. I can't believe that you're a racist, and this is ridiculous. We don't tolerate race. That's not it at all. The tone is, this is a social media problem. People have to use their social media correctly. And if you're going to be online and representing our company, then you can't be posting anything that is going to portray us in an adverse manner publicly. I think that is hugely significant because, to me, it's showing we don't necessarily have a problem with white supremacy or you practicing white supremacy. We just want to make sure that this your racism does not cause us any problems, does not drive up the cost of the business of white supremacy. I think folks have made that distinction. But if anybody heard that portion, the fire segment, did that stand out to anybody else? Because I think that's a pattern that we are kind of paying attention to, if other folks have noted that the problem seemed to be a violation of social media policy, not him being racist.
I think it's a kind of a deflection for them to kind of quell the fire, if you will, whenever issues or accusations of racism come up, so that way they can deflect the problem to something else and not really address the big problem.
And then I would just add, it seems that in a refinement stage, it seemed like the white people get punished for stepping out of bounds, like in the refinement stage, like Dr. Welsing said, don't call the niggas niggas. So if a white person step out of bounds and become unrefined, then they get punished. And it seems like, in my observation, they almost delight in punishing the people that step out of bounds because, like you said, they're driving up the cost.
Let's make sure we are watching.
Yes,
I just wanted to give the prompt about reminding the metaphors. Step out of bounds is a metaphor. Stoking the coals is a metaphor. It was a few of them have come in. I meant to get that in as well, watching the metaphors. Proceed, retired firefighter.
Yes, the cost of refining racism is a lot more than just the blatant acts and or behavior of racism. So that tells me that white people are willing to punish other white people. That is making the cost, the financial and time and energy costs of refined racism go up even higher by not following the rules. As I've heard it stated before, that white people would remind other white people about the white person who is not following the order of things as what the most powerful white people deem as being what we should be doing as far as practicing racism. So, and on this particular situation, what, from my experiences, or what would be the final official statement would be not necessarily practicing racism on behalf of that white employee, but like you said, that the misuse of the technical devices that we have on the job. And I can't remember for sure, because when I was retiring is when it was just at the point where they were getting having, you know, technical devices like utilizing computers on the trucks and at the stations themselves. But they probably have some kind of rule about in the terms of, you know, you can't misuse this technology. You, in other words, you're not home to be able to say those things. And even if you're home, you know, I guess you could get in trouble that way also, but nevertheless, especially on the job, you can't utilize these technical devices in that way, and if so, you would be disciplined for it. I just wanted to add on another weak comment based on something that I thought of during the week. As we know, this is an Olympic year where the Olympics is taking place. It's taking place in, as most of us know, that I think it's called the second largest area on the earth of concentrated of people, non-white people, in a place that's called Brazil. From our understanding, the majority of the non-white people, especially, don't care anything about the Olympics, don't want the Olympics. As far as that taking place, and I know it costs billions of dollars that could be going towards something far more better constructive for the majority of the people in that part of the earth. I would say that just like anywhere where there's high concentration, especially of non-white black people, they're not doing too well. Most of us are not doing too well. There have been a lot of reports, and most of them have been negative about the arrangements and construction and preparation for the games in itself, including the water being dirty, which we know all over the world, not just in Flint, Michigan, but all over the world, that is a byproduct of racism, white supremacy, that non-white people's water would not be proficient and healthy. Which is a fundamental way how you can mistreat people. You don't have to be there. Just mess up their water, and you don't have to worry about it. They are going to suffer in the worst kind of ways.
Yeah, Olympic year. Also, there has been, since the inception of what they call the modern day Olympic Games, there's been efforts to divert away from what they call politics. It's actually, in my mind, is a code for of non-white people recognizing the global system of racism, white supremacy, and how it is been a detriment to quality of life. But there have been efforts since the beginning of the modern day games. We all know about Avery Brundage and his activities. And it still carries on to where they kind of discourage any demonstrations at all. We all know about the famous iconic salute, quote unquote, Black Power salute, it was called, by Tommy Smith and John Carlos. That and also with a lot of other non-white Black people in that games who made lesser known demonstrations. But I'm thinking that something is going to happen at this games also, because there are similar characteristics as what was happening in Mexico City in 1968, where I suspect in 68 there was a lot of non-white people who are called Mexicans who were suffering at the time also. And we also know on how the young Black athletes, male and female, already were organizing to whereas they were going to attempt to make some sort of demonstration globally to racism, white supremacy in this part of the world, to the world itself. But with all of the different things that are happening in 2016, I'm kind of like saying, you know, stay tuned. Something may take place during that time. Although the Olympic Games is not as popular as it used to be, it still is going to be something that's on television, and still going to be reported. So that gives a place to where a lot of things could happen in an event such as that. So just my observations on the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Thank you.
I think this is going to be like whites when it's all done. I think this will go down as probably the worst Olympic event in history, just because of where it is, the timing, as you said, and it being such a high concentration of heavily melanated people. There, I think that is the highest concentration of melanated folks in this hemisphere. I think just even the reports that I've been seeing, the Zika virus, and I mean, I cannot recall an Olympic event where so many people have been saying we should cancel it, we should postpone it, we should move it. Like it's been, they've been saying that all year long, just with the Zika virus and everything else, the poverty that they have in that area of the world that is all the fault of racists. I even saw a report this week where they said body parts are washing up on the beach that's close to where some of the activities are supposed to be taking place for the games. That's my suspicion is going to be the worst Olympic event in history by the time it's all done.
Yeah, I've seen all of those reports also, and as I mentioned before, what makes it similar to Mexico City is that it was a similar, in other words, they just put patches over and kind of like insulated the compounds where the athletes stayed at, the events that you saw on television, and right outside of those partitions was non-white people suffering. And I would say that issue is much more prevalent in Brazil than what it was in Mexico City, because I just from my observations that it is so prevalent to me that the vast majority, which you hardly ever see on camera, the vast majority of people in Brazil are non-white people. You hardly ever see them on camera. I think it's done by purpose. don't even want it. Don't even want the gangs. Never said they wanted the gangs at all, and they're certainly not going to benefit from it. I mean, something similar like that happened in Atlanta, when it was in Atlanta. I mean, it wasn't like a lot of black people benefited from the Olympic Games, even when it was held down here in Atlanta. And it's even worse because many more non-white black people in that part of the world than it is in Atlanta. Stay tuned. That's what I'm saying. Stay tuned.
For sure. We have less than 30 minutes. If folks had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in before we wrap up, you should get your hand up now and not wait till the last minute. I did press *6 if you're on the line and you had commentary you wanted to share. I think the female caller, she was talking about the, I guess what they call this colorism conflict that is instigated by whites, having highly melanated non-white people in some sort of conflict with less melanated non-white people. Colorism, I think they call it, in relation to what happened with the finals and or what happened with Jesse Williams, the actor. He gave his speech at the BET Awards this week where he was talking about racism, white supremacy. Number one, I'm suspicious of both because I have seen colorism addressed, and that's the term that they use, addressed in relation to both of those events, like in mainstream articles where people talked about that in terms of Mr. Williams. This would be another example where I have said consistently, I do think it's relevant. Not that the person should be mistreated or anything like that, but I do think it's relevant. Jesse Williams has a white parent. Where people have talked about him and saying that they, you know, think that if that might be, he's able to do this because he does have less melanin. He doesn't look like Samuel L. Jackson. He doesn't look like Lupita Nyong'o he doesn't look like Viola Davis going up there and making these comments. That may or may not be true, but I am a tad suspicious. I'm not saying that black people have not made comments about him. And made comments where they're upset, because somebody wrote that on my Facebook page saying that they saw a lot of black people making comments where they were upset with him, or saying, you know, he's too light to be up there talking about racism and blah, 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 and, you know, just being disparaging of what he had to say. And the same thing with Stephen Curry. But I do think that whites, who are the source of this problem to begin with, I do think that in a very disingenuous fashion, they will focus a lot of attention on that, because I have seen quite a few articles talking about that with Jesse Williams and certainly with the finals. They have been talking about that all month long. And oh, my gosh, it's terrible. Like, can you see what the niggers are saying about Steph Curry because he's light skinned and this is terrible? And again, I'm not saying that this is not happening. I think we talked about this issue on the program before, that what they call colorism. Huge problem. 2016 continues to be massive problem. I think if you do a search, light skin versus dark skin, you'll get like probably close to 10 million hits, probably more coming. But all of that is a product of white supremacy. And the same thing I told a listener, black people squabble and argue with other black people for any reason. You're too light. You're too dark. You've read too many books. You haven't read enough books. You didn't too much school. You haven't been to school. All of that is a product of white supremacy. Any reason will do to be in conflict with other victims. With the finals thing, because like I said, I've seen a lot of that. I've seen a lot of that over the past month or so. And even with Jesse Williams as well, even though I didn't see as much of it, I'm very, very suspicious that racists are deliberately using that sort of angle. And I do think racist white supremacists, I do think in the system of white supremacy, black get back, yellow mellow. I do think that racists, they are much more accommodating in how they treat victims who have less melanin, representing a less threat to white genetic annihilation. I do think that that's the case. I do think that that's been demonstrated, not for years, for centuries. But that still would not condone, not encourage any sort of conflict or being upset with anybody because they have less melanin. The problem is whites. But I do think that they have done a very deceitful, devious job in how they have manipulated this to just get the focus back on. Might even just be another refined way of just saying, oh, the problem is black on black crime. Look at how you all are treating one another. I will pause there.
I think when I had saw the speech he gave, because normally I don't even watch programs or shows like that, because it just it's discouraging to see how distracting you know, white people are, you know, can be in our lives. And so when I happened to see the clip up until they took it down, I don't know whether it's up still now. Basically, I was just, until I saw that he was with a black female at first, I was a little bit apprehensive because, like he had said, you know, they do give a little bit of leniency towards less melanated people. But afterwards, when I saw his wife, I was just like, oh, okay. So that kind of helped. But I, like I said, at the end of the day, he made some valid points, and he definitely had, from what I saw, white people in the audience a little bit uncomfortable.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, last but not least, just wanted to report on the trashy and tacky tactic that racists have been doing with, I don't know if it's Mrs. or Miss Dash, every time a non-white person says something that is, in my view, would be accurate to the global system of racist white supremacy, they would call Ms. Dash up and to have her to say something that would be countering to that. I mean, it's like obviously, and with Ms. Dash, she said what she said. VGQ. As far as I'm concerned, I am focusing on the white people. Yeah, because this is a tacky and one of their tacky and trashy daily maneuvers, and it's kind of like so obvious because it happens more and more with as far as white people as far as activities on what they do to attempt to confuse non-white people on the issue of racist white supremacy. So I just wanted to mention that as far as another particular episode with that tacky and trashy tactics and strategy. Thank you. Mm.
Incidentally, that was my response to what Mr. Jesse Williams had to say as well at the BET Awards. He said what he said. And he has been speaking about racism for a while now, not like he's not that old, so I mean, certainly not as long as Dr. Welsing or anything, but I think he was prominently speaking out when the Ferguson situation happened, when Michael Brown was killed, and a lot of the other incidents. He has been prominently speaking for a while, but I had the exact same response when all that went down about what Mr. Williams said, or Stacey Dash, or really any other victim of racism. She said what she said, he said what he said. The problem is still white people. The caller at 5136, did you have commentary as well?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How you doing, Gus? Honor to be on your show. I was just listening, first time caller. That's all I would like to say. It's a good show. It helped me out a whole lot. Thank you.
Grand first time caller. Grand to hear from. We've had a few of those this week. Great to hear new participants sharing their views, observations. Other folks have any commentary they want to make sure they added in? Anybody else see the responses, I guess, to what Mr. Williams had to say, whether people were appreciative or upset about what he said, or neither here nor there? Did folks have any other commentary on that?
I heard Whoopi Goldberg, I guess, had given him some pushback about what he was saying. I guess you could say, you know, that was, you know, her response was to be expected, especially because I guess she's been intimately involved with white men. So, and from what I've seen most of the time, she tries to, not tries, but she's, I feel that she's been conditioned, I guess, kind of like not as bad as Stacey Dash, but, you know.
I think it was Justin Timberlake. He was, I think he made a post on Twitter, and from my understanding, it's been reported that, I guess it was some of the victims, you know, they asked him questions, you know, said, hey, what are you talking about? Where were you when what happened to Janet Jackson when all that went down? He was like, oh, you know, I should have stuck by a lot more, and you know, that seemed to fit the topic perfectly about the appropriation. And I guess he was probably trying to be a little sly, you know what I'm saying? You know, I'm very supportive of what you're saying, Jesse. And that one suspected race soldier, that I think her name is Tommy Lauren, like a lot of white people seem to be like galvanized by, you know, her style of speaking. Another, I guess, she's trying to be like Ann Coulter in a way, but like I noticed she doesn't really have interviews with other people. Maybe it was one or two people, and she was speaking very fast, like at a very fast pace, and just a lot of inaccurate things she was saying about unarmed black males and stuff like that. So yeah, I noticed the response was very intensified. And if I can add in another thing, like nobody's really, everybody seemed to have forgot that Justin Bieber, he was on tape, you know, singing One Less Lonely Nigger, you know, and he's still standing in front of the cameras, you know, smiling and everything. Like, that's power right there.
He's from Canada, and he's a young white person, so he was just a little ignorant. We just need to get him a little racial sensitivity class, and he'll be good to go to. And I think he apologized, so all is forgiven with Mr. Bieber. I think that was how they moved forward from he just spent too much time around black people as well. I think that was part of the explaining as well, that he's around a lot of black people who say nigger all the time, so he's been desensitized. He didn't think he was doing anything incorrect. I came across it almost accidentally. If the people that participated in the book study session on Leonida McLean's A Foot in Each World, the black journalist, she committed suicide in the 1980s, 84 specifically. She wrote for the Chicago Tribune. She wrote all about racism. Her ex-husband edited the volume, Clarence Page. Mr. Page wrote a editorial response to Jesse Williams' commentary where he said, and it was in the article, it was in the title, he said, if you're going to respond like that, then don't leave out black power. And he said, why don't you also, you know, take black people to task for wearing their pants down and saying nigger and black on black crime? Like, why didn't you make equal time to make sure that you get at other black people? Why is it just one-sided where you're just going to call out white people? And I was just kind of laughing at first, like, really? That's, how interesting. But that is Miss McLean's ex-husband. He did write that piece earlier this week, and I had same comment for him. He said what he said, because he is a black male. Moving forward, the problem remains racism, white supremacy, white people.
Confusion is lethal.
Tell me about it.
And Eminem pretty much was in the same predicament as Justin Bieber a few years back. I guess especially when he was being the greatest rapper of all time or something like that. I guess he got caught in some tapes from way back when, talking about black females and using the N-word and stuff. And unfortunately, other confused black people came to his rescue to explain away the racism. So.
Happened with Jimmy Incognito as well. Black people, victims, came to be a character witness and say that he's not a racist. This was the former football player for the Miami Dolphins. I think he's with the Buffalo Bills, or he got picked. Whites don't get fired. They get transferred. He's with another team now. But same thing. They said he's not racist. I also thought it is of note. You kind of have to see how this evolves. Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, where she, I don't even know how to phrase it. They had the controversy where apparently, I guess, she had a meeting with former president, Negro favorite Bill Clinton, and they're having the investigation about Hillary Clinton's emails, and did she do something incorrect, and should she be charged, and blah, blah, blah. And Loretta Lynch, she came out to give her commentary just to make sure that people didn't think that she was influenced by talking to Bill Clinton and that she's going to do what the FBI investigators recommend. She's going to follow their recommendations, and there's not going to be any impropriety or favoritism just because she spoke with Bill Clinton. I would just keep and remain alert. Keep some focus on that as it evolves, because I could easily see them blaming this black female, first black female attorney general. I could easily see her people blaming her if this works out in a manner that people don't like, or if they just want the situation, the narrative to be that this black female played some role in the demise of Hillary Clinton and how Donald Trump was able to get to the White House. I could see racists making that a part of the narrative if they so choose, but that is something to kind of be mindful of as things proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say, I think a lot of times black people cover up for white folks like that because they're scared. They're scared that they're going to lose what little bit of crumbs that they got, whatever, like Clarence Page. He writes for some big white newspaper, and he probably, you know, he has to talk like that. And just like Leonard Pitt, saying, I used to really like, and I used to save a lot of his clippings, from the newspapers, but he started getting a lot of death threats from white supremacist groups. So I noticed that he's toned his rhetoric way down, and he's not the same as he used to, and that's why I think a lot of them are scared. I wouldn't be surprised if Jesse Williams might come out a few months later and say that he didn't mean things the way they was interpreted or something, like if they threatened to fire him from that show or something. I think a lot of black people really, really, really do want to say and do the right thing, but they're just afraid. And I mute myself.
I agree completely. That's why I think it's most accurate to use the term terrorism, because that is the result of terrorism, is fear. And I absolutely think that, I mean, when you are in a system where racists dominate all areas of people activity and can make decisions about whether you have access to clean, uncontaminated water, can make decisions about whether you have employment, can make decisions about whether you're going to be in greater confinement, whether you get to keep your residence, absolutely, that would make you fearful about losing any of those things or doing some direct harm to you or people that you care about. Absolutely, if that means that, you know, I have to change up the way that I talk about racism or not talk about it at all, absolutely, that is the result of terrorism. So absolutely, I'm sure that that is the case, and that is whites have a long record of that sort of behavior of terrorizing black people so that we are fearful of doing anything to upset them or drawing any attention to racism, white supremacy, out of fear of the consequences.
I just wanted to emphasize on how shrewd Mr. Clinton is
he reminds me in my imagination of a crime boss, a gangster, where he actually kind of like caught Mrs. Lynn. Is that her name? The Attorney General?
Lynch.
Lynch, I'm sorry, Mrs. Lynch, off guard with the idea in mind and knowing of having a conversation with her, with the idea of mind of when it's all said and done that she has some sort of sympathy in some way with her, with his wife, who is vying for president. And he is, you know, being the manager behind it all. I mean, that was just typical of a powerful white person, and even more precise, a powerful white male. And unfortunately, too many non-white black people actually marvel at the behavior, as opposed to understanding on what it is. It's a picture of a powerful white person practicing racism in the most shrewdest of ways. He is not ignorant to anything that he says and does at all. And he did what he did, in my view, on purpose, with the idea of mind of persuading this lady towards the presidential candidate who happens to be his wife.
Very logical. Very logical. I certainly would hope nobody thinks that former president, former governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton, is ignorant about racism. Any final comment anybody need to get in before we get ready to wrap things up?
I'd like to say something.
Yes, sir.
I wish I would have listened. I know we come to the end of the show, and you say, if you're going out, notice the 4th of July weekend, not to drink, stay at home. I just, like I said, I'm a first time call. I just started listening to the cows about three months ago. And I wish I would have heard you, because I had suffered from a DUI. And you say, and I know you say things can go real south real quick. And that is so true. So I would like to say, if you're going out, you want to party, do it at home. Because like Gus say, if you're out there, things that go real south real quick. And that's all I like to say. Thank you.
Man, thank you for sharing that. Man, I super appreciate it. Best commentary of the day, because I know that is not... I understand for workplace racism and a lot of aspects of racism, it's not like it's fun to call in and talk about how we have been abused and terrorized by racists or things, you know, where we wish we had made a better decision. That's not exactly the most fun thing to call in and share with a bunch of strangers. But man, that is so important, not just for this weekend. I'm just saying it for the holiday, because that tends to be a time where there's even more alcohol, even more of a reason to, you know, get intoxicated and act a fool. But that's one of the easy things. That's when people talk about agency. This is one of the things where we do have some control. We do have the power to say, well, hey, I'm not going to give racists one nickel of my money for any of their poisons, so that, you know, they can have me locked up or have some sort of ticket or mess up my license or anything because I was driving under the influence or walking under the influence or anything. Just that's one thing where I think we could minimize some of our problems, just recognizing that there is a war being waged against us in all areas of people activities at all time. And there is no time where we can afford to not be thinking clearly, to make bad decisions, or to get stuck, because you just never know when you are going to be in contact, when you will be forced. When a white person says, hey, stop immediately, right now, whether it's an enforcement official or just a regular white citizen. You never know when you're going to run into them. And as the caller just emphasizes, I try to say on a regular basis, things can go bad quickly. And they often do in the system of racism, white supremacy. We don't have backup. They do. Keep that in mind this weekend. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. But if you can't do that, get to one spot and stay there. I mean, that's a part of codification. You have your plan. I'm not doing the sober thing. Forget what Gus is talking about. I'm going to have a good time. Fine. Get to one spot. Designate a residence. If it's going to be your residence or somebody else, get there and stay there. Spend the night there. That way, when you leave the next day, you can be sober. You can go about your business. You don't have that as a problem, because, I mean, it's certainly enough black people who get stopped and pulled over where they are totally sober, and it still ends up being a life-ending experience. Insert Sandra Bland or any other name that you need to. That's documented. We understand that. So you do not want to make it any easier for race soldiers, Daniel Pantaleo, Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw. You do not want to make it any easier for them to come and rape you, take your life, have you in greater confinement, even if they just give you the ticket and you end up having to go to court and pay all these court fines and get an attorney and do this community service. They put restrictions on your license. Those are easily avoidable problems. You know it's a holiday weekend. They are going to have sobriety checkpoints out in full force, and they disproportionately deploy those in black areas. Recognize that and plan accordingly. And again, you can eliminate all that. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. And certainly buckle up every time you're going to be in a vehicle. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. With that said, we should be here tomorrow. As I said, I'm looking to make sure we get confirmation from our guest, Steve Jimenez. His book, The Book of Matt's, what it's called, about the alleged hate crime that took place in 1998, Wyoming, with Matthew Shepard. The thesis of his book is that this was not a hate crime, that these were individuals, Matthew Shepard, and even the individuals who were convicted of his murder. They were all involved in drug use, drug sales, maybe even escort service in some, solicitation, but bartering, exchanging sexual activity, sexual favors for drugs or profits or whatever the case may be, that there seems to be a lot of evidence that all of them were involved in this, that they all knew each other prior to this murder, and that this was not a hate crime, that Matthew Shepard was not killed because he was gay, and that the prosecuting attorney in this case and many of the enforcement officers who investigated this case, that was the conclusion that they came to as well, that this has been widely and wrongfully reported as a hate crime when there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that at all. He should be with us tomorrow. I insist this is important because this gets brought up all the time compared to racism, white supremacy. They brought it up with the Orlando Club shooting. We should pay attention. We had an incident in the news clips this week where some white male alleged that he was beaten up because he was gay. And then they went and investigated and concluded that this person lied and that was not the case at all, that he wasn't even beaten up. He just made up something for whatever reason. That right there could be a massive act of white supremacy. But I'm hoping we can do that tomorrow. Should be normal program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. That would be a book I would encourage folks to read because there's some direct racism, white supremacy in the book as well. But this is a very important case. If you look online, if folks remember James Byrd Jr., the black male who was dragged behind that truck in Jasper, Texas in 1998, they named the hate crime bill the James Byrd Jr. Matthew Shepard hate crime bill. I mean, in my view, it does not get clearer than that in terms of white supremacy. This is a drug fiend. This is a alleged drug seller and drug user who was killed, not because he was gay, but what could have just amounted to a drug deal that went bad. Looking forward to that tomorrow. If you have questions, problems, can't find something in the archives, gripes, guest suggestions, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Invest if you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com.
listener-supported counter-racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported 7+ years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. With that, again, remain safe for the next 4 or 5 days, as safe as possible. If you're in the States, if you're not in the States, I guess you don't have a holiday associated with all this, so just continue your counter-racist codification. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.